His reports keep coming in for a while, so no one will question his sudden disappearance.
Bryce, I don't want to appear ungrateful, but how do we keep his reports coming in, huh? A seance?
No. I compute the physical characteristics of his head. Then I print his memory, his synaptic circuits.
His synaptic circuits?
His mind, you know. The brain is only a binary computer, a series of on-off switches. Then, Mr. Grossman, I can generate this man onto the screen from my computer. He'll be able to continue his program, and no one will know. But he will, in fact, be computer-generated. Just like the parrot.
The parrot?
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Welcome to 2021. Let's hope it's going to be a bit better than 2020, although I have my doubts personally. Helping me review this week's and the last 3 weeks, really, news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Back after our break. Martin, did you have a good break?
I've had a holiday and I'm now back in school. Because I'm working in a special school, so I've had a break.
Did you have a good one? Did you see any?
It was all right. I mean, it was it's been not been a normal Christmas for me as for everybody else.
Are you allowed to tell us who you've met? You've met your family or not?
Well, I met my parents who've been self isolating. My dad's had the first of the Pfizer injections. My sister's boyfriend, who works in hospital, has been sent home with COVID, and she's self-isolating with him.
Any symptoms?
He had a cough, the last I heard.
Right. In the second part tonight, we have a roundup of non-COVID local, national, international news. Plus, as part of that, Trump, including a Canadian perspective on events this week in Washington. As Putin bans them, we take another look, a deeper one this week, into the religious cult, that is, the Jehovah's Witnesses. We heard from Cain and his wife last month. This month, tonight, Ed was an elder with the Witnesses, and he felt, no pun intended, the cruelty and the bullying that he witnessed was certainly not Christian and left him with no choice but to leave. Plus, the plight of Hong Kong, handed to China by Prince Charles back in 1997 by treaty. Three quarters of MPs in their Legislative Assembly arrested this week and then let go on bail, which is more than can be said for Julian Assange, so we'd be looking at him too. And a close look this week at Prince Charles's role in the Great Reset, as well as his role as a Middle East peace negotiator, instigator, and war over the years. Also, his prominence as Prince of the UK, but King of the Globalists, the man behind much of the climate science lobby. And I look ahead in what Messianic Jew Tim Cohen believes will be a battle for Jerusalem in the future. And you can hear a lot more of my longer interviews, the ones we haven't had time to broadcast, on this stream throughout the rest of the week. My three books published in the 3 weeks of the Halloween lockdown, The Traitors of Arnhem, The Siege of Heaven, and The Siege of Heaven Reader, I'll be sending the free versions of these out with my weekly email. Even though I've been slightly thwarted by good old Eric Schmidt and Google, and the weekly email list, Google list, has been stopped. They've just stopped sending the emails. I send them to the list, and then they don't go anywhere. They just go into a big black Google hole. So, and I send them this weekend, these emails. You can always email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk with stories, but you can also email me if you want to be added to that list, and I'll have to get a new one set up. Probably one of those ones you have to pay about £50 a year for, because Google just doesn't want to distribute this. They say a lot of it is medical misinformation. So I guess that's where we should start, Martin, not with medical misinformation, but on censorship. One of the things that Google have decided is that if anybody questions the efficacy of masks or social distancing, that's it, they're banned.
Yes, I know. What do you want me to say about that? We know that that's what's going on.
Do you think that's acceptable?
Well, Google is a private organisation.
Well, Martin, I'm not asking. I mean, this is the answer you always give, a pat answer. Do you think it's okay for any kind of media company to say, well, there's going to be no discussion about the topic of masks and no discussion about the topic of social distancing, as Google have done there?
Okay, well, there's two aspects to this. One is, should governments be allowed to ban things like this? And, of course, governments are under obligation to, A, allow freedom of speech within certain parameters, in theory, and B, they've also got, in the middle of a pandemic, a public information message that they want to communicate, whether you agree with it or not.
Well, they can do that, can't they? Hang on, they can communicate that message, Martin. They can communicate that message, but are you saying that you think it's right that social media platforms, etc., should not allow that message to be questioned? This is
if it was a government social media platform, we wouldn't have to discuss the third point I was going to make, which is about private ownership of media platforms. Don't forget, Tony, I'm a socialist. I believe that media platforms of monopoly power like Google should be owned by the government. And if it was owned by the government, we could then enter into an argument about what and what should not be allowed on such a platform in such circumstances.
Well, in fact, it's likely that a government platform would be even more strict about the freedom of speech there.
Indeed, it probably would. But of course, they would also have to fulfill the criteria that they allowed an agreed freedom of debate, whatever we agreed was a free, whatever we agreed that to be. But of course, the real get out clause for all of these social media companies is that they are private organisations like the Daily Mail. The Daily Mail is under no obligation as a printed platform they can put anything they like out. And you buy it or you don't buy it, you buy into it or you don't buy into it. Things which are controlled by the government, and I believe that they should be controlled by the government, then you've got an obligation to allow debate within certain parameters.
Yeah, but we don't see much about what those parameters are. We don't see any obligation to allow debate on the BBC.
Well, we do. The BBC is not the Daily Mail. It's regulated by Ofcom, as you know, and Ofcom may, of course, be influenced in the wrong direction because the government is in control.
I mean, you're just kind of digging yourself in a hole here, because there's much, much less debate on the BBC than there is on Murdoch platforms like the Daily Mail or Talk Radio.
Well, indeed, because the point about the BBC is they can't print any old stuff or say any old stuff because they've got an obligation to in theory, to provide balance. The Daily Mail and Google, as private organisations, and this podcast, for example, we're under no obligation to provide balance. We can say what we like.
Well, I think actually we are, because that makes
only morally
that makes a podcast more credible. But anyway, Martin, you've rehearsed these arguments from a long time ago. But I think, just like with Julian Assange, that there should be freedom of speech, and if you're not pushing for it and making sure there is some sort of balance, and we're going to be hearing that tonight on this podcast, most definitely from everybody from the doctors that feel that they're completely aggrieved to Bill Gates himself on the opposite side of the spectrum, that's what you're going to get. To me, that's journalism. Otherwise, it's all just propaganda. But anyway, so let's have a listen anyway to begin with. We're maybe starting off on the right foot this year, Martin, with a listen to Bill Gates, because he's the monopolist behind Windows, Microsoft, a man who's made a lot of money really through the Central Intelligence Agency and making sure that the operating system which most people use in the world, Windows, has got back doors for the Central Intelligence Agency for the United States. And he's made an absolute fortune on that, making himself, I think, actually maybe not the richest man in the world. Elon Musk looks like he's just overtaken Bill Gates as the richest man in the world. But anyway, he's a major funder of what is now the global health regulator and policy body, the World Health Organization. And he was on the BBC just before Christmas, around Christmas time anyway, on a program called How to Vaccinate the World. So I thought it'd be interesting to hear what Bill Gates has got to say about the vaccinations and how to vaccinate the world, and particularly how we've coped with this pandemic.
If you catch a pandemic early, then the pandemic is like it was in Australia or New Zealand or Taiwan. It's not a big deal. It's when you let it exponentially grow to these big numbers that then it overwhelms your hospitals, you can't do contact tracing. And so the countries that had SARS or MERS, you know, some of them actually did get the diagnostic testing contact tracing up, and, you know, their situation is utterly different than most other countries.
Yeah, I've been fascinated by the psychology of SARS and the response of the countries who were hit by SARS, because I think it seems for them it was wow, that was really bad, that really hit our economy, it could have been so much worse, we need to prepare. Whereas for those of us in the West, more distant, it's, the lessons seem to have been different. The lessons seem to have been, oh yeah, these things come along and people like Bill Gates always make a fuss, and it's all fine in the end. And SARS was fine in the end. We learned a different lesson.
That's right. You know, when a small earthquake comes, does it make you think they'll all be small, or does it, you know, mean you do the building codes and get ready for the big one? For wars, we invest a lot. You know, for fires, we invest a lot. But now pandemics, at some level, you know, we'll expect our governments to have experts and think ahead so that there is no repeat.
So that's Bill Gates there on the BBC in really what was an absolutely appalling interview, because the questioner there on Radio 4 didn't ask him a single difficult question. In fact, lots and lots of nice, easy questions. And really, I suppose, sort of stroking his back as he was interviewing him, whereas Bill Gates has actually got lots and lots of very important questions to answer, not least of which is the number of countries where he's been kicked out and his foundation have been kicked out for killing people and injuring people with their vaccine trials, and also allowing vast sums of money per trial in the, particularly in African countries, usually roughly about $30-40 million per trial, in order to bribe officials not to prosecute them, and also to pay off anybody that tries to take them to court, and in terms of compensation, so they're not giving compensation to anybody that isn't actually trying to sue them. So when it comes to Bill Gates rolling vaccines out, Martin, the track record he's got is not a good one.
No, I agree. And of course, what the BBC are doing now is that they're trying to, you know, there's a lot of pressure coming down the line to try and stop what they regard as misinformation surrounding the pandemic and vaccines and so on. And it's a kind of scare tactic that's used, that anybody who's criticizing this is basically potentially, you know, putting people at risk. And I think the BBC very much is in not taking risk mode. We've just had changes at the top in the BBC, where two lifelong Tories have been put in charge of day to day running, and the BBC, you know, the top of the BBC, I've forgotten the names of them. And, you know, they're being dragged into line by the Tory government. And the Tory government at the moment doesn't want the BBC, you know, and if you work for the BBC, you'll be very well aware of what the limits are to what you can say, and you know, you're not allowed to ask difficult questions for people like Bill Gates.
Well, it's not just that. You're not allowed to say anything outside, you know, for example, on social media. People, BBC journalists, can now be sacked China style for saying absolutely anything which is that one of their managers deems to be controversial on social media. Even if you say it anonymously, if they track it back to you, then you can lose your job.
Well, in the past, of course, BBC journalists like Paul Mason were able to work for Newsnight as their economics correspondent, and they also had an independent life on Twitter where they critiqued government policy and so on.
Well,
and
he
if you think about it, if you're going to have independent journalists.
He was doing lectures around universities. He was writing books as well. And now it seems...
What the government now is saying is, if you work for the BBC, all you can do is your BBC stuff. And if you've got opinions about anything else outside of that, then you're not allowed to have them if you're going to work for the BBC. I think that's wrong. I think basically the BBC should have a spectrum of journalists. And of course, they've got to work when they're on the BBC within the BBC's guidelines. But what they do outside that should be relatively free.
It's a bit controlled. a bit like China. So, I mean, is there some sort of similarity, do you think, between the attempt to rein in journalism in Britain and the same in China? When we're putting in the backdrop of this, of course, Julian Assange, having actually committed no crimes, just dishing the dirt on corrupt officials and arms dealers, etc.
Well, I think, you know, all government, I would argue that there's a legitimate role for what you might call government-controlled media. You know, I do frequent stuff for Russia Today. You do stuff for Press TV. They are government-controlled media from Russia and Iran, respectively. But they have to work under Ofcom rules, although, of course, as you know, Press TV were removed. You know, Ofcom kicked them off the satellites and so on. And I would argue that if you're going to work those rules, you've got to show some commitment to balance in what you're doing. And that doesn't mean you can't have people with opinions on, but you've got to balance the opinions over your output and all the rest of it. And of course, we've got Murdoch at the moment, who is pushing to have a Fox TV in Britain. And the Tory government are quite keen for him to get that as a way of further hobbling the BBC and creating competition for
them. Well, he's lost Sky, hasn't he? So I imagine he wants himself a channel.
Yeah, well, he's pushing for, you know, basically Fox UK, effectively, is what he wants. And, of course, there is a real question about whether Fox does fulfil the criteria that Ofcom could accept in this country, because, you know, it's blatantly partisan TV. And you've got it all over the world. I mean, you know, private sector TV, Globo TV in Brazil, NTV is used to be run by Berezovsky in Russia, Berlusconi's TV channels in Italy, they would not be able to function under Ofcom rules in Britain because they're blatantly partisan. Now, you might argue that it's OK to have partisan TV. OK, but in that case, don't argue that it's balanced.
I don't think Ofcom's been very effective, because I think almost all television nowadays is in one way biased. In a way, it might be better to just not regulate it and allow, so the viewers would be able to select. But the trouble is, you go on places like Freeview, if you're talking about television, or on the digital spectrum on radio, and quite often it's just impossible to find anything worth listening to.
Well, that's the problem with the, as we used to say about the hundreds of channels in the US, it's hundreds of channels of junk. Now, the purpose of the BBC...
Well, I think Floyd weren't quite so polite, were they?
No. But the thing is, something like RT, for example, they model themselves in many ways on the BBC. And in other words, there's got to be a calm, balanced approach to what you're saying. Obviously, it's the Russian government's position rather than the British government's position. But they can't, for example, just rabble-rouse in the way that Fox TV
What I'm getting at here is, I think we've got more and more propaganda coming out on these channels. Even in RT, I'm noticing, for example, there'll be a report of what was going on in Washington this week with drum roll music or an orchestra banging the big bass drums in the background, make it almost like the drums of war. You know, this to me is not journalism. It's more like theatre or drama, and they seem to be doing that, I suppose, just going for ratings. But it's not really journalism to have this kind of, you know, exciting music in the background as you're seeing what's going on in Washington as the Capitol building is invaded.
Yeah, I agree, but I think ultimately you can't stop in the modern media environment lots and lots of voices being heard. But what you can do, if you have a stable government, I mean, Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Polsat, if you're going to have government TV in the mix, that has to create a kind of standard against which the more shouty partisan TV can be judged.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to do, but I don't think the BBC's done that really since the 1980s or 90s with Alistair.
Well, their independence has been gradually eroded.
Okay, well,
nevertheless, the idea of having at least one channel that does that is a good one.
It would be nice, wouldn't it? We heard a bit from Bill Gates there. I laughingly put it up on online as the Bill Gates Christmas message, because he wasn't being interrogated by the BBC at all. It was really just almost like the Queen getting a chance to say what she wanted to say with a little lapdog, puppy dog, you know, sort of slavering at her feet, or his feet in this case. But there's some quite important stuff has come out about vaccines. One is around, and I'm going to put these links up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the lack of testing of the vaccines which have been being approved here in the UK by the MHRA on the frail and elderly. So that is a report by the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention in the United States. But there's also another report from the UK. So, Martin, this is a bit worrying, isn't it? If elderly people who are frail, many of whom are in care homes, they're talking a lot of the time now about these people getting vaccines, and yet the frail elderly have not been actually even part of the trial. So in a way, if a frail elderly person now gets any of these vaccines, that they are part of a trial in themselves. I'll put links up, by the way, to these articles from the UK and the US on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I mean, isn't it possible now that some people are almost guinea pigs in the continuing trials of these very fast rolled out vaccines?
Well, and obviously these vaccines have been rolled out far faster than would normally be the case. And, you know, the argument in favour of that is, you know, this is an emergency and so on and so forth. And of course, the vaccine companies have got, they can't be sued. And if any old people, if it does come out that they're not safe and old people or other people die or have negative effects from it, they will sue the government because the government has taken over that role of being the guarantor of the safety of the vaccines. Now, obviously, there's a big question mark underlying that with all vaccines and all medicines. And, you know, the regulatory system is a very, very important thing. And the checks and balances within it are extremely important.
It's not important here in Britain, is it?
If they exist at all. And, of course, Fred Palmer in the West is basically given a license to print money and take risks.
Well, exactly. And as we reported before Christmas, when the Pfizer vaccine was rolled out, you've got June Rain there representing the MHRA in public. Only trouble is the chairman from last year has gone because of a scandal where they approved mesh for women's prolapses and for hernia operations without even doing any testing at all. And as a result of that scandal, the MHRA chair had to resign. That's why June Rain is the one who's giving these announcements now.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is what economists call, potentially what economists call regulatory capture. So in theory, the government regulates the sector to make sure that you don't have quacks. I mean, some guy today went into somebody's home and supposedly gave this 90-year-old the vaccine and took £190 off her. That, of course, is not allowed. But at the same time, the regulatory structure can itself be captured by private interests, which is one of the reasons why, just as we should have nationalised media, we should probably have to have nationalised pharmaceutical companies, which, of course, they do in some parts of the world because they're communist countries.
Yeah, well, you've brought in another interesting side of all of this, which is barely talked about anywhere, and that is the big bonanza that this whole pandemic has been for organised crime. The idea here that is that there's a black market, Martin, opened in all sorts of areas that might have been normal. Now you can pay whatever, double, three times the price and go and get what you want on the black market.
Well, I mean, the wealthy are always going to buy their way to the front of the queue with stuff. If that's what I mean, Murdoch is in this country at the moment and has already been vaccinated. Meanwhile, on Fox News in the US, voices who are saying that vaccinations are dangerous, whatever, are still functioning. So there's a lot of contradictions in all of this.
Well, I think it's important that we do hear that, because we know in the past on our program for the last, whatever, 3 or 4 years, we've been covering quite a lot of damage that vaccines can do. And it does seem that the point of all of this is all around the 1986 in the United States, where the government indemnified Big Pharma for any death or injury, whether permanent or temporary, caused by vaccines. So this has really been a carte blanche for the vaccine companies to go and roll out anything, so long as they can get it approved and they don't suffer any financial consequences if people die.
Well, that's right. And ultimately, you should take the private profit out of all medical stuff completely, as is done in Cuba, for example. They've developed two vaccines which are totally produced by the Cuban state, and the Cuban state decides whether they're safe or not, and then they get them out in the countries all over the world where they're operating. The big pharma argument about big pharma in the West is really to do with the way that capitalism works in the West. It's not about the goodness or badness of vaccines as such. Vaccines are a potentially useful tool. The problem is that everything in the West is dominated by private profit, which then, of course, poisons the well.
Well, let's get on to one of your pet subjects, which is the lab leak hypothesis. The New York Mag last week actually published what I think is one of the best articles I've seen so far on this. It says, for decades, scientists have been hotwiring viruses in hopes of preventing a pandemic, not causing one, but what if? ... That's by Nicholas Baker. The hypothesis from this article is, I'll just read a little bit of it out. He says, it's worth offering some historical context for our year-long medical nightmare. We need to hear from people who for years have contended certain types of virus experimentation might lead to a disastrous pandemic like this one. And we need to stop hunting for new exotic diseases in the wild, shipping them back to labs and hotwiring their genomes to prove how dangerous to human life they might become.
Well, I don't think there's any justification in my mind for taking naturally occurring viruses and doing research which actually makes them more deadly.
Well, and what this
is been going on.
Sorry to interrupt, but what this research is doing, the article says, is the scientists have been developing ingenious methods of evolutionary, what he calls acceleration and recombination, and they've learned how to trick viruses, coronaviruses in particular, those spiky hairballs of protein we now know so well, into moving quickly from one species to another, from one type of cell culture to another. They've made machines that mix and mingle the viral code for bats and for humans. Diseases like SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, for example, and MERS, Middle East respiratory syndrome, which broke out a decade later and has to do with bats and camels. Some of these experiments, the gain-of-function experiments, aim to create new, more virulent or more infectious strains of disease. Now, it's a terrific article. I would love to see it in one of the national papers here, or certainly even discussed or debated on the BBC, which I think is, I'm not holding my breath for that. But I mean, this is delving into an area which we really do have to understand the origin of this, Martin, don't we, if we're going to actually deal with it, because otherwise this is going to go on forever.
Well, as I say, I don't think it should be going on at all. And where it has been going on, it relates back to the 1940s and the creation of biological weapons by the Japanese and the Germans in particular. All of that research was taken over by the Western powers when they took over in Germany and Japan, and they continued it. And DARPA, which is one of Dominic Cummings' great hobby horses, because DARPA in the US has been a source of all sorts of new technologies, according to him, and we need a similar organisation in Britain. That is part of the Pentagon. The Pentagon is actually experimenting with making viruses more dangerous, and there's brilliant articles about this by the Bulgarian journalist, I think it's Gazev, I can't pronounce her name and I've forgotten it off the top of my head, but we'll put a link up to it, presumably. But she's been saying that they've been opening biological warfare facilities all over the former Eastern Bloc. What are they doing there? And they're carrying out this kind of game of function.
Ilyana Gatasheva?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Another aspect of all of this is it was dealt with by an article on the AIER, I'm not quite sure what that stands for, website, and it's called Asymptomatic Spread Revisited. This is, I found, a fascinating read, and it is all fully referenced. So, you know, anyone looking to try and take us off of YouTube or whatever needs to look at this. The phrase fog of war, they say, is attributed to Karl von Clausewitz. It's come to refer to the confusion and uncertainty felt by everyone in the midst of a conflict. It's often unclear who's making decisions and why, and what the relationships are between the strategies and the goals. I think we can say that absolutely 100% for the way that our British government has dealt with this, as well as many other governments. Even the rationale can become elusive as frustration and disorientation displace clarity and rationality. The initial round of lockdowns, it goes on, was not about suppressing the virus, but slowing it for one reason, to prevent hospital capacity. Whether and to what extent the curve was actually flattened will probably be debated for years, but back then there was no question of extinguishing the virus. The volume of the curves, tall and quick or short and long, was the same either way. People were going to get the bug until the bug burnt out, which would mean herd immunity. But gradually, and sometimes almost imperceptibly, the rationale for the lockdowns changed. Curve flattening became an end in itself, apart from hospital capacity. Perhaps this was because the hospital crowding issue was extremely localized, and they're talking here about New York, while hospitals around the rest of the country had emptied out for patients who, many of whom, did not show up, where 350 hospitals in the US furloughed workers. So this article really goes on to look at this whole business of asymptomatic spread, Martin. It says asymptomatic spread was the answer given to the great question, if I'm not sick, why should I be locked down? And what could it mean in any case to be sick without symptoms? Why are half the PCR positive tests assigned to people who otherwise seem to be perfectly well? These valid questions came to be answered by one phrase, asymptomatic spread. You might not feel sick, etc. So then the article goes on to look at various of the surveys which have shown, particularly from the World Health Organization itself, Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, who's the technical lead at the World Health Organization for COVID-19, where actually what she's saying is it's very unlikely that there is asymptomatic spread. So and then there's another report from China, Martin. I know you're a big fan of China, where they're saying that in Wuhan, the survey they did, which included millions of people, found absolutely no asymptomatic spread at all. So I'll put a link up to this on our show page. But I wonder what you make of the ability to actually increase the fear factor by beefing up any kind of idea of asymptomatic spread.
Well, let's come back to an even more fundamental point. Ultimately, the countries which have succeeded in dealing with this pandemic have gone for zero transmission of COVID. Zero. Not flattening the curve, zero. It's only when you've failed to do that that you then move into the second phase, where you've got to deal with a situation where you haven't killed it down to zero. Now, in actual fact, if it was only one small country like Iceland which had got it down to zero, you could say, oh, well, that's just Iceland. But when a big country like China, with possibly a quarter of the world's population, have got it down to zero and are supposedly where it actually originally came from, then it shows that everybody else simply hasn't got it. And of course, there is no trade-off between the economy and getting rid of COVID. It's a bit like you can't have a little bit of inflation, as they used to say on the right wing of economics, because inflation builds on inflation. So in actual fact, you've got to go for zero, and you've got to go for zero from the get-go. And if you don't do that, you're then in a difficult position, very difficult position.
Yeah, well, what happens when you only find out you've got a pandemic maybe a quarter or a third of the way into it?
Well, if in that situation,
you can't go to zero. That's impossible, isn't it?
But of course, the Chinese, it's not clear that it did start in China. There's lots of questions about where it did come from. But let's presume, for the sake of argument, that it did. And they moved very rapidly because they've been partly because of the SARS experience, which you mentioned earlier, but also because they've been preparing for a biological warfare attack by the West for years. In the Korean War, And of course, in Cuba and other places, the West has been trying to infect hostile societies with chemical and biological weapons. And the communist intelligence services in those countries are very well aware of that, and they've got a plan in place to deal with it.
OK, well, what about now here in Britain, though? Because a lot of people have pointed out that in January, every year since the Conservatives came to power and Andrew Lansley did his Health and Social Care Act, there has been a crisis in our hospitals. There's been queues of ambulances outside accident and emergency services. It's just that this year, for the first time, it's actually being blamed on COVID, whereas in the past it was just blamed on Tory cuts.
Well, I'd have to say the crisis, Jeremy Hunt, I'm not a big fan of Jeremy Hunt, but he was earlier on the media saying this is far worse than a normal crisis in Britain. And of course, there is a question about the previous years, there's always been a crisis in and so on. But don't forget that we've had several lockdowns which have actually suppressed the usual flu symptoms. And a lot of these people going into hospital are dying of COVID. I mean, that's just what's happening, Tony.
Well, also, what about dying of flu?
Well, some people used to do die of flu every year, as we know, but this is not what's happening yet. COVID isn't flu. It's just not flu. It's something else, isn't it?
No, but
it's probably a biological warfare agent, as I've suggested many times.
Martin, the PCR test is picking up flu as COVID.
Tony, there's 1,000 people who died today in British hospitals of COVID. And it's probably, as we've been discussing, a biological warfare attack on China, which has gone wrong. And therefore, you've got to treat it as warfare, not as debate.
Well, I think your figure of 1,000 dying of COVID is wrong. What you're talking about there is people dying with a positive COVID test in the last 28 days, and it's not the same thing. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Boris's announcement, because he's made a big announcement, didn't he, at the beginning of the week, saying, oh, sorry, everybody, after all those lockdowns, well, we're just going to have, we're just going to have more lockdowns, and we're going to have to keep going with lockdowns indefinitely, a little bit like, you know, the war on terror going on indefinitely. The PM addressed the nation as he announced a full lockdown for England at the beginning of this week, which rather put the cat amongst the pigeons, as a lot of people invested money into making sure that their pubs were going to be open, their shops were going to be open. Oh, no, we're not going to be allowed to do it. So let's have a listen to a little extract from the PM's speech now.
As I speak to you tonight, our hospitals are under more pressure from COVID than at any time since the start of the pandemic. In England alone, the number of COVID patients in hospitals has increased by nearly a third in the last week to almost 27,000. And that number is 40% higher than the first peak in April. On the 29th of December, more than 80,000 people tested positive for COVID across the UK, a new record. The number of deaths is up by 20% over the last week and will sadly rise further. And my thoughts are with all those who've lost loved ones. With most of the country already under extreme measures, it's clear that we need to do more together to bring this new variant under control while our vaccines are rolled out. In England, we must therefore go into a national lockdown which is tough enough to contain this variant. That means the government is once again instructing you to stay at home. You may only leave home for limited reasons permitted in law, such as to shop for essentials, to work if you absolutely cannot work from home, to exercise, to seek medical assistance, such as getting a COVID test, or to escape domestic abuse. The full details of what you can and can't do will be available at gov.uk/coronavirus. If you are clinically extremely vulnerable, we're advising you to begin shielding again, and you will shortly receive a letter about what this means for you. And because we now have to do everything we possibly can to stop the spread of the disease, primary schools, secondary schools, and colleges across England must move to remote provision from tomorrow, except for vulnerable children and the children of key workers. Everyone will still be able to access early years settings such as nurseries. We recognise that this will mean it's not possible or fair for all exams to go ahead this summer as normal. The Education Secretary will work with Ofqual to put in place alternative arrangements. We will provide extra support to ensure that pupils entitled to free school meals will continue to receive them while schools are closed, and we will distribute more devices to support remote education. I completely understand the inconvenience and distress this late change will cause millions of parents and pupils up and down the country. Parents whose children were in school today may reasonably ask why we did not take this decision sooner. And the answer is simply that we've been doing everything in our power to keep schools open, because we know how important each day in education is to children's life chances. And I want to stress that the problem is not that schools are unsafe for children. children are still very unlikely to be severely affected by even the new variant of COVID. The problem is that schools may nonetheless act as vectors for transmission, causing the virus to spread between households. Today, the United Kingdom's chief medical officers have advised that the country should move to alert level 5, meaning that if action is not taken, NHS capacity may be overwhelmed within 21 days.
NHS capacity might be overwhelmed within 21 days. Well, it's been being overwhelmed within 21 days for the last, 8 years, Martin.
I mean, you can't just argue that there is no second wave, Tony. I know you argued on this podcast some weeks ago that there was no second wave. I think that's just not the case, is it? There is a second wave. There it is.
Well, there's a second, there's a massive lockdown and there's an enormous crisis in the National Health Service. I don't think that proves that there is a second or third or fourth or whatever it is wave at all, especially since, as you've heard, there's lots and lots of contesting of what Boris is saying there. He's saying that there's an enormous amount of spread going on within schools, asymptomatic spread, and we've just heard that there's evidence against that. This is why I'm rather disgusted with the mass media and the way they've just completely failed to address these really knotty issues. And the only way they do it is they say, oh, well, there is asymptomatic spread. They present a couple of people who believe there is, and then they pretend, and they're lying to us as they pretend that, that there is nothing in order to counter those arguments. There are no experts around the world to do it. I think we started off on the right foot anyway, having Boris and Bill Gates, you know, the big advocates of the lockdowns, the advocates of the global pandemic, the biggest reaction possible. And I know, Martin, you actually also believe, don't you, that this should really be used as an opportunity maybe to give everybody a universal basic income?
Well, it would be nice. I'm not holding my breath for that. I don't think you can see Boris Johnson as somebody who's been a big pusher of lockdown. He's been trapped by his own party into locking down far too late three times in a row. And he's basically, look at the U-turn he had to do. On Sunday last week, he was saying schools are opening on Monday, so we're all getting ready to go. Then on Monday evening, after everybody's gone into school and passed on whatever they've caught over Christmas, they finally face reality that schools have to be closed down.
So
they should have closed them down before Christmas.
Is Boris in charge, or is Sage and Nerve Tag running the show? Because it looks to me as if Boris is just doing as what he's told by his scientific revolving doors advisors.
Well, the scientific revolving doors advisors, as you called them, were calling for a lockdown before Christmas, and Boris was resistant. Don't forget, last year, Rishi Sunak was pushing for Eat Out to Help Out, and it looks like that was a bad decision, Tony. Bad decision. And, well, of course, if you keep making bad decisions, you carry on having to go in and out of lockdown, unlike in Wuhan, where everything's functioning.
Well, you remember the very first programme we did when I was over in New Zealand, when this all started back in March 2020, we were looking at an article from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology that said, oh, we're not going back to normal, saying that it was going to be a deliberate process by which society is going to be opened up, then the figures were going to be exaggerated, then they would be locked down again. And the idea was to subject humanity to a shock doctrine treatment, a kind of electric shock treatment. We'll give you a buzz for a while, then we'll give you a bit of freedom, then we'll give you a buzz again. And that was predicted back in March 2020.
Well, you know my views on this, Tony. I think this is a biological warfare attack on China, which was just about to take over as the biggest economy on the planet, bigger than the US. And don't forget, there was a trade war, and Pompeo was saying, we've had enough of China. And then suddenly, bang, this kicks in. And of course, the purpose of that was to wreck the Chinese economy and allow it flow back over the Western economy so that you could then get into this, what you're talking about, the psychological warfare aspect of COVID.
Right. But you see, what you've got is you've got characters like Neil Ferguson are actually driving policy. He's at Nerve Tag, even though he's basically Gates sponsored. His entire career for the last 20 years has been paid for by Bill Gates at Imperial College. And he's exaggerated swine flu. He's been exaggerating pandemics. That he's actually made a habit of it over the years and made a massive career and a lot of money doing it. And in fact, he's built up a whole department at Imperial College with Gates' money doing this stuff. But the question is, why is he back? Because he was we were told, weren't we, back in, I think it was April or May, that he was sacked because even though he had been the one pushing for the lockdown, he wasn't actually obeying it himself. He didn't believe it himself. So the physicist, yeah, well, he's not actually not a biologist. He's a physicist. He doesn't even have a biology O level, as he himself cheerfully admits, Peter Hitchens said last week in his Mail Sunday column. So these are the people who are running this, Martin. Peter Hitchens says effectively he is a member of the new and emerging respiratory virus threats advisory group. That's called NERVTAG. And he was only ever away from that for a couple of weeks. So he's amazing. A mission by Ferguson made in a recent interview with the newspaper The Times. He spoke of Sage's growing admiration, like you, for China's tyrannical attempts to contain COVID. They thought with good reason, apparently, that the dishonest and repressive Chinese state was covering up the truth about Wuhan, and they may still be covering it up. After a trial of a few hours, Zhang Zhan, 37, a Chinese former lawyer and citizen journalist, was sentenced to 4 years in prison. She was arrested in Wuhan in May for picking quarrels and provoking trouble. It's one of those crimes used against dissidents in China, and then charged with disseminating false information. She went on hunger strike, Hitchens says, against her treatment. But this is China. It's not a free country, a bit like Assange here in London, isn't it? Her lawyer says that she had a feeding tube forcibly inserted and her arms restrained to stop her pulling it out. So this is Sage basically picking up Peking's COVID strategy. You seem to say that that's a good thing.
Well, let's unpick some of this. This person that's been arrested in China, she's not from Wuhan. She travelled into Wuhan and she works for, I think it's called Epoch Times, which is a CIA-funded propaganda organ which tries to undermine the Chinese government. What I am arguing is that there has been a biological warfare attack on the Chinese by the Western powers, which was designed to trash the Chinese economy, but it failed. It was also allowed to flow back over the West, because they're quite happy for that to happen so that they can then bring all the lockdown measures and all the stuff that you're talking about. But underlying all of this is not an exaggeration of a normal situation. It's a warfare situation. And we've been at war since 9/11, possibly since the bombing of Piazza Fontana in 1969. We're dealing with evil people who do evil things. They don't just exaggerate pandemics, they create them.
Do lockdowns work? It doesn't seem they do.
They do if you do them quickly enough. And of course, if you don't do them quickly enough, you've got to do them longer.
What happens if you don't do them quickly? Do they work then?
No, you just got to do them for longer. And what happens then is that your economy is destroyed, while other countries like China, who haven't got a lockdown, their economy and the economy of Taiwan and Vietnam are going to grow this year. They're the only three economies in the world which will grow. And of course, over time, that means they're going to win World War III because they've worked out what's going on. And of course, the West is going to lose because they started it by creating a pandemic, not exaggerating a pandemic, creating a pandemic. They probably created COVID and seeded it in China. I can't prove that.
It's quite feasible, but I wouldn't necessarily agree that we need to be locking down and doing these PCR
There's
tests.
There's no other alternative, Tony.
Martin, there is an alternative. Yes, there is an alternative, and not just by vaccination. What you can do is start using a sensible test like the lateral flow test and only testing people who actually are ill. Anyway, Charles Walker is an MP who responded to Boris Johnson's announcement of another lockdown in England. And he said that and we're going to hear from a bit of his speech now, because they do allow the MPs to vote on it, even though only a handful voted against this latest lockdown. Charles Walker was one of them. And he spoke out because he said he couldn't support criminalising a parent for seeing a child.
Walker. Thank you, Mr. Deputy Speaker. Mr. Deputy Speaker, I can't support this legislation tonight. I can't support criminalising a parent for seeing a child in the park over the coming months. It's not within my DNA to do that. But, Mr. Speaker, of course I will follow the law and respect the law. You have the argument in the House of Commons. You divide, you're on the winning side or the losing side, and I will be on the losing side. There is no doubt of that. But I do not wear the fact that I will support the law with great virtue, because it's so easy for me to comply with the law, isn't it? It's so easy for most people in this house to comply with the law. We're comfortably off. We live in nice houses. We have gardens. We have outdoor spaces. We have access to family. The same applies to those journalists who fill our TV screens every night with their wisdom and wit about how people should comply with these regulations and how they sneer at those that can't. But Mr. Speaker, Mr. Deputy Speaker, the next 3 months are going to be really, really hard for a lot of people. A lot of people who don't have my advantages, my advantage of a monthly salary, a monthly pension payment. These are people who are going to be worrying about their jobs, about their future, about their mental health, about their family relationships, because they will miss people terribly, or they will be in very small environments where apparently they can only leave to exercise once a day. And then, sadly, some of these people are going to break, and it's going to be too much for them. And that is when we in this place, the journalists up there with all their privileges, instead of sneering and dismissing them, instead of calling them COVIDiots, should show some compassion and understanding, because we should wear our advantages and privileges with great humility. I don't want to hear from another constituent who's having a good lockdown. I'm really pleased that you are, but my voice is for those who aren't, for those of my friends and neighbours and constituents who are struggling day in and day out, whose mental health is not in a healthy state but has deteriorated, who are wondering how over the next few months in the middle of winter they are going to cope with this. So in my remaining remarks, can I just ask colleagues, can I just ask people out there who were so fortunate to show some compassion and understanding for those who are not so fortunate?
So that's Conservative MP Charles Walker there in his speech in response to the recalling of Parliament over the new year to enable this act to lock down England again for a couple of months. Martin, maybe you could say something there about, I mean, why aren't we hearing this sort of thing from the Labour Party? You know, looking at the number of people who have either just simply run out of money, now facing eviction, or they've lost their jobs, their businesses. It's absolutely decimated the poor, but the Labour Party seem to want more and more of this.
Okay, can I just quickly pick up on what you said before we went into that clip about testing everybody? There is a city in northern China where they've had a new outbreak this week. Everybody in that city is being tested. That's the first thing. I am going to have a lateral flow test on Monday, because I am now a key worker. I have to go into school to work with vulnerable children. I'm so I'm going to be tested, even though I've got no symptoms.
These are good tests, these.
Sorry?
The lateral flow test is a good test.
Well, I'm going to have one on Monday, Tony, because I'm a key worker. Okay? And in China, they've had an outbreak of COVID this week, and everybody in the city, it's a big city, I can't remember the name of it, is going to be tested.
Okay, so are you getting tested weekly or something, Martin?
Well, I don't know. I'm going to be tested on Monday. Nobody knows. One of my co-workers has had a text message this afternoon to say that she's going to be one of the first people to be vaccinated. Anyway, my father, as I say, has already had the Pfizer vaccine.
Yeah, we're not really talking about
state.
What Charles Walker had to say, and that
yeah,
was
okay. Well, I just wanted to get
going
that
to
stuff
be
in
the,
before
what's
we move on.
The consequences for the poor, because the rich are able to ride this out, the poor are not.
No, well, what we really need to do, as I've said before on this show, and it's called for by the People's Assembly, is we need 100% lockdown, and we need everybody paid 100% of their wages, and that's going to push the debt of the country way up. But that's no problem, because we're going to either get money back by allowing inflation, or we're going to take it in a wealth tax.
So it's Richie Sunak got a magic money tree?
Yep, magic money tree. And if, of course, the magic money tree can't do everything, that means a wealth tax on all of the people whose asset prices have gone through the roof as a result of QE, which was brought in from September last year before this crisis broke. The asset owning classes have seen that the stock market is now, can you believe this, at all-time highs.
Martin, you haven't addressed anything that Charles Walker said there. So you think it's okay because of an annual problem with the National Health Service not being able to deal with stuff because of the Tory cuts to stop parents seeing children in the park?
I didn't say parents. Who's saying that parents can't see their children? They've got to. We've got household bubbles.
This is as part of this lockdown. So no, it may
if
be.
If you're going to get rid of the virus, what we really need, Martin, and what we should have had from the get go, is a proper lockdown. And we're going to have to go on for longer than we probably otherwise would have because we've messed about with this.
Martin, if you're going to ask me a question, you've got to allow me to answer it. What the Charles Walker is talking about there is not necessarily about one household bubble, but it's, say, for example, a parent who's separated from another parent being able to see their children as part of an arrangement in the park. So, you know, surely that should be all right.
I think that what we really need to do now is have a proper lockdown. And it's probably going to have to be more serious than would otherwise have been the case because we've messed around with this too much.
That's certainly what Boris seems to think. Look,
no, it's not what Boris seems to think. Boris wants to end the lockdown as soon as possible.
Lockdown. He's just brought one into law. What about the fact that a lot of these activities by the government now are making it impossible to do political organisations, to demonstrate, and also even to get together in private to run a political campaign?
Well, that's a very big question, isn't it? But if you're going to get rid of COVID, you've got to have a lockdown. That's my argument. You don't agree with me, but you know, we don't have to agree. And the Labour Party has taken the view that the natural fact, what's happened here, is that they've been messing around and not getting the lockdowns done properly. And you'll see the same kind of arguments being made in Scotland, in Wales, and in Northern Ireland.
Really,
it's in England where we've been dragging our heels.
Yeah, the Labour Party's argument is that we haven't locked down enough, or long enough, or with enough penalties. But I think my sense in this most recent lockdown, where we're speaking in the first week of January 2021, is that there is not anywhere near the stomach amongst the public to have another lockdown like they had back in March. People just simply don't believe that the government's got a coherent policy, Martin.
Well, they're right that the government hasn't got a coherent policy. But if you look at the opinion polls, and this is one of the reasons, it's the only reason why the government has U-turned. They looked at it and saw that the Labour Party's position of saying we need a serious lockdown and we need it soon as was actually overwhelmingly supported by the public. And there was only 9% of people who said that they agreed with the government's policy of trying to carry on blundering forward without one. And at that point, Boris Johnson changed his mind. As Michael Heseltine says, what he does is he waits to see which way the crowd is running and then he runs in front of them and says, follow me. Now, in actual fact, a lot of the problems in Britain is because we've got an absolutely incompetent Tory government that isn't capable of managing a piss up in a brewery. And that's just our bad luck, isn't it?
OK, so also let's just go and look at what's been going on in the States for a minute, because in New York, RT, your favourite people are reporting, Martin, that there's a new law now setting up detention centres to lock up suspected COVID-19 cases. And apparently it heralds a Kafkaesque nightmare. Under the new law, New Yorkers are dragged out of their homes and locked up just on suspicion of possibly having been exposed to coronavirus. Now, this is starting to look a bit more like a police state, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I've not seen that report, so I don't know how to comment on it.
This is, I mean, you know, if you're, but basically what they're saying is that if you are traced through contact tracing, that the police can come to your house, drag you out, and put you in a detention centre.
Well, that's exactly what they did in Wuhan, if you remember. They traced everybody, and there was no kind of, I'm not coming to this centre to be isolated. You're going, because it's warfare, Tony.
Yeah, I think in the other, who's fighting who? The people fighting the government fighting the people, or the virus? No,
the Communist Party of China versus the Western globalists.
Yeah, so also in Singapore, all this contact tracing information is being shared with the police. So it starts off as something which is for your health, but then you suddenly find out, well, actually, we've seen that, you know, you're connected with somebody who's a criminal, and therefore we're going to come and raid your home.
Well, what you'll find in warfare, as in world, what you had a clip from Neville Chamberlain before Christmas. Is in warfare, the normal rules of what you can and can't do change. And this is actually warfare, Tony. That's my argument. This is warfare, not against a virus. It's actually World War III we're fighting. Some countries have already worked out what to do and they're doing it. We are blundering around. Ultimately, if somebody is infected with COVID, they have to be self-isolated. We haven't done that properly in this country. We're not tracing anybody. We're just sending them home to convict them. What they did in China is they took them away and isolated from their families so they couldn't infect their families.
Permanent lockdowns almost forever.
Well, they've got to go on for a very long time if you mess up at the early stages of the war.
What I'm saying is...
A bit like World War II. If you miss the boat in the early stages, you're then going to be on the back foot for the first 2 or 3 years.
You're not the only person saying that. According to Uğur Şahin, one of the world's leading vaccine minds and a Turkish-German doctor who's also top dog with the German company BioNTech Pfizer, the biotech firm that won the great COVID-19 vaccine race of 2020, the COVID-19 coronavirus will likely stay with us for about the next 10 years.
It's quite possible, but of course in China, as long as they keep everybody out, they won't have to suffer from it.
So we
by the end of 10 years, with 10 years of coronavirus in the US and 10 years of no coronavirus in China, they definitely will dominate the 21st century.
Because of the bumbling and the bungling, we're going to have 10 years of lockdown. Is that right?
Well, we'll have to have as long a lockdown as we need to get rid of the virus in order to compete with our main competition, which is the Chinese Communist Party.
Well,
until you get to base one, you're not even going to be able to.
A lot of doctors and epidemiologists will say you can never get rid of the virus. Once it's there, it's going to hang around forever.
It's outside China now, and it's not coming back, and they're not going to let it back in. Their economy will carry on growing. The Russian economy is threatened, very much so.
Martin, we're talking about the UK, not China.
Well, the UK is part of the global West. What will probably happen because of the mistakes that have been made, including allowing ourselves to be in alliance with the United States, which probably started this whole process by infecting the Chinese with COVID, because of our alliances going back to World War II, we are probably going to, and of course other things that have gone on like Brexit, let's not go down that road, the British economy is basically stuffed. And ultimately,
a lot of young people, 50% of
the population, Martin, I've only got one thing to look forward to, which is wealth redistribution.
Martin,
nothing else will
do. You may well be right with your opinion polls saying that people who believe that they may well catch this COVID-19 still and die of it certainly do support lockdowns, but there are a lot of young people that don't, and one of the things that they've been doing is having raves. In fact, we had a techno party at the Muslim holy site which drew hundreds of people and censure from the Palestinian leadership. They didn't like it. Rather interesting, the idea of having Israeli Jews and Palestinians having a rave. They believe that they aren't going to die of this, so why should they even be involved? In fact, there's a lot of young people think, well, I'm going to catch it. That's actually good for me. I would rather catch it and not have a vaccine. The other thing is on LBC, they're reporting raves in Manchester. In fact, that's one of the big things that's been taking place, particularly on Boxing Day, traditional day for raves. You know, as the Tories go out hunting on their horses, so the left, if you want to call them that, the traditional raver types, they'll go and have a rave. So don't you think there's a legitimate reason why young people actually want to catch this, Martin, so they don't have to have a vaccine?
No, I don't, actually. And I was an original raver back in the 80s. If you go to a rave, you may asymptomatic COVID, but you can then pass it on to somebody else's granny. And they didn't go to the rave and they didn't choose to go. It's a question not just of your personal freedom. I mean, a rave, frankly, if you've ever been to one, especially indoors, is just about the perfect conditions to spread it. Everybody's sweating. Everybody's breathing out the atmospheric, you know, that's the whole point of raves. So if you wanted to catch, if you just got one person with it in there, everybody's definitely going to get it.
In Brazil, their attitude has been to legislate against anti-vaxxers. So the Brazilian Supreme Court has ruled against the COVID anti-vaxxers. This is according to, what is this, WA Today. I think this is a US publication. Brazilians required to be vaccinated against COVID-19 under the penalty of being banned from public services and places, the country's top court has decided. 10 justices of the 11-member court backed the mandatory inoculation with only one vote against in a virtual session held on Thursday, Brasilia time. This was at the end of December. It's a ruling, it's a blow to President Bolsonaro. He said he won't be vaccinated and nobody should be forced to. Well, it looks as if his own law is going to force him to get vaccinated, Martin. Well, I mean, what is the point of vaccinating somebody who has caught COVID and is actually immune to it?
Well, if they've already got antibodies, there's no point vaccinating them at all. It's a waste of a vaccination, isn't it?
Well, why is the Supreme Court in Brazil saying that Brazilians are all required to be vaccinated under the penalty of being banned from public services and places?
Well, because Bolsonaro was a COVID denier at the very early stages, very much so. And of course, he's also opposed to taking a vaccine, etc. And the judiciary in Brazil is not necessarily entirely under his control, which is a good thing, frankly. And that what they're saying is we've got to get this vaccine out there because we haven't really discussed, you know, there is an alternative to permanent lockdown. And this is what Boris Johnson was dangling in front of us like a carrot, is if we get enough people vaccinated, then we can end the lockdown. And of course, that's the thinking behind the decision in Brazil.
Okay, so one of the things we haven't talked about yet either, Martin, is the treatments that are available for COVID, which are being blocked in the West here. I mean, the most, I think, one of the big smoking guns of this whole affair was the article, I think you pointed it out to me, actually, was by Pepe Escobar in the Asia Times, that the French, back in the middle of January, before this was really even a news story in Wuhan, confiscated the entire country's supply of chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine, which is an anti-malarial drug, which had been available up until the middle of January over the counter in France. You didn't even need a prescription for it. And suddenly the French government confiscated all of it, knowing that it was the most effective treatment for SARS-CoV-1 back in 2003-2004. The tests that were done in 2005 as well proved that this was an absolutely brilliant treatment for it, an antiviral. It's what Stanley Lehan, we had on, the doctor from Florida, called serendipity. This is a anti-parasitic drug, anti-malarial drug, but it actually also happens to be a very strong and effective treatment for COVID, an antiviral drug. That's hydroxychloroquine. But there's another one of these drugs that Dr. Stanley Lehan mentioned when we interviewed him back, I think it was in November, a really fascinating interview, which you can still find on our archive. I think I'm right in saying that those absolute scumbags, is probably the best word I can use to describe them, at YouTube, have decided that his lifetime of expertise is not worth listening to and banned it. Probably Bill Gates had a personal word with Eric Schmidt and said, can you get this interview removed from YouTube, because Stanley Lehan was saying that this drug we're going to hear about now, ivermectin, is also a very effective treatment against COVID. It proved to be, as it proved to be against the first SARS-CoV-1. So let's have a listen now to one of these hearings, government hearings over in the United States, where Dr. Pierre Corey talks about the way that ivermectin has been prohibited to be used for COVID, where he believes it's one of the most powerful and effective treatments, even though, of course, it costs only a fraction of what a vaccine does.
After 9 months, and I have to point out, I am severely troubled by the fact that the NIH, the FDA, and the CDC, I do not know of any task force that was assigned or compiled to review repurposed drugs in an attempt to treat this disease. Everything has been about novel and or expensive pharmaceutically engineered drugs, things like tocilizumab and remdesivir and monoclonal antibodies and vaccines. We have 100 years of medicine development. We know we are expert in all the medicines we use, and I do not know of a task force that has been focused on repurposed drugs. I will tell you that my group and our organization, I will say that we have filled that void. That is all we have done is focus on the things we know and things we do. And I'm here to tell you, Dr. Ryder, he just presented. He has one study of the many that I want to talk about. And I want to talk about that we have a solution to this crisis. There is a drug that is proving to be of miraculous impact. And when I say miracle, I do not use that term lightly. And I don't want to be sensationalized when I say that. That is a scientific recommendation based on mountains of data that has emerged in the last 3 months. When I am told, and I just had to hear this in the opening sentence, that we are touting things that are not FDA or NIH recommended, let me be clear. The NIH, their recommendation on ivermectin, which is to not use it outside of controlled trials, is from August 27th. We are now in December. This is 3 to 4 months later. Mountains of data have emerged from many centers and countries around the world showing the miraculous effectiveness of ivermectin. It basically obliterates transmission of this virus. If you take it, you will not get sick. I want to briefly summarize the data. My manuscript, again, published by some of the most, we have contributed more to the medical knowledge of our specialty in our careers than anyone else can claim as a group. And our manuscript, which was posted on Medicine Preprint Server, details all of this evidence. I want to briefly summarize it. Number one, we have evidence that ivermectin is effective not only in prophylaxis, in the prevention. If you take it, you will not get sick. We just came across a trial last night from Argentina by the lead investigator of ivermectin in Argentina, Dr. Hector Carvalho. They prophylaxed 800 healthcare workers. Not one got sick. In the 400 that they didn't prophylax with ivermectin, 58% got sick. 237 of those 400 got sick. If you take it, you will not get sick. It has immense and potent antiviral activity. We know that from the first study in Monash, it has made the bench to the bedside. Prophylaxis, we now have 4 large randomized controlled trials totaling over 1,500 patients, each trial showing that as a prophylaxis agent, it is immensely effective. You will not get sick. You will be protected from getting ill if you take it. In early outpatient treatment, we have 3 randomized controlled trials and multiple observation as well as case series showing that if you take ivermectin, the need for hospitalization and death will decrease. The most profound evidence we have is in the hospitalized patients. We have 4 randomized controlled trials there, multiple observation trials, all showing the same thing. You will not die, or you will die at much, much, much lower rates. Statistically significant, large magnitude results if you take ivermectin. It is proving to be a wonder drug. It has already won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2015 for its impacts on global health in the eradication of parasitic diseases. It is proving to be an immensely powerful antiviral and anti-inflammatory agent. It is critical for its use in this disease. We, again, stand by our manuscript. It is a scientific manuscript. It's been submitted for peer review. But please recognize, peer review takes time. It takes months. We do not have months. We have 100,000 patients in the hospital right now dying. I'm a lung specialist. I'm an ICU specialist. I've cared for more dying COVID patients than anyone can imagine. They're dying because they can't breathe. They can't breathe. They're on high flow oxygen delivery devices. They're on non-invasive ventilators and or they're sedated and paralyzed and attached to mechanical ventilators that breathe for them. And I watch them every day. They die. By the time they get me in the ICU, they're already dying. They're almost impossible to recover. Early treatment is key. We need to offload the hospitals. We are tired. I can't keep doing this. If you look at my manuscript, and if I have to go back to work next week, any further deaths are going to be needless deaths, and I cannot be traumatized by that. I cannot keep caring for patients when I know that they could have been saved with earlier treatment, and that drug that will treat them and prevent the hospitalization is ivermectin. I am here today. I'm calling to action. The NIH, their last recommendation was August 27th. August 27th. I want to be clear. I am not here as a politician or a dramatist or sensationalizing what I'm recommending. I am going to be very clear and very simple. All I ask is for the NIH to review our data that we've compiled of all of the emerging data. We have almost 30 studies. Everyone is reliably and reproducibly positive, showing the dramatic impacts of ivermectin. Please, I'm just asking that they review our manuscript. It is a serious manuscript by serious, highly experienced physicians and researchers.
That's Dr. Pierre Corey speaking in the United States about 2 weeks ago about this drug ivermectin that he's seen actually have a massive effect on slowing down the ability of the virus to actually kind of replicate in our bodies without the use of any kind of expensive vaccine that Bill Gates wants us to use. Now, Martin, it's incredible, isn't it? Well, when politics and medicine get involved with each other, it's almost bound to end in tears, isn't it?
Well, it's not just politics. It's also the economics of the Western pharmaceutical complex. They would, as he points out, they'd far rather find a new expensive drug, which means that they make loads of profits, than use an old inexpensive one because they don't make any money on that. And of course, coming back to the sort of World War III scenario I was outlining earlier, if you know, you can imagine that people like the Chinese or the Cubans might look immediately into this and say, right, we need that. That's what we're going to use rather than your stupid vaccine.
Well, absolutely right. And it's quite clear that right across Asia and Africa, the use of hydroxychloroquine manufactured in India and shipped in plane loads to many countries in Africa has saved tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands of lives in those continents. But it was basically banned from being used in Europe and the United States, really, I suppose, by the chief scientific officers of governments and the regulators, who said to the doctors, we don't want to see any off program use of the of hydroxychloroquine. Particularly, that's the one I've seen the orders sent out saying that you're only allowed to use chloroquine for as an anti-malarial drug. You're not allowed to use it for COVID. Now, you know, some doctors may be brave enough to prescribe it, but you see, then the trouble is, if they do that, then they may be sanctioned by the government, the British Medical Association, or whoever, for going against the government guidelines, which is, I suppose, why what I'm coming around here to saying is how important the free speech on the radio, the television, in the newspapers is for these doctors. And yet they've been censored. Many doctors, have been around the world. People like Dolores Cahill, the World Doctors Alliance. And in this case, it's Dr. Pierre Corey. Nobody's listening to him. And his 25 pence a tablet cure for COVID.
Yeah, well, I am prepared to listen to him because that's worth listening to. But of course, this is all gets mixed up with people like Dolores Cahill being super pro anti-EU, for example. She's got a political background and she's also against masks, which I think is silly. And of course, then they say, well, there's the conspiratorial anti-vaxxers over here. They don't believe in masks. They don't believe in lockdowns. And of course, it just tends to come across as if they're just against anything.
I think there's a tradition, as I understand it, in the West of informed consent, and actually a very, very strong tradition of going to several doctors sometimes to get second opinions. It seems to me that now there's only just one opinion and you've got to have that. There is no second opinion.
Well, don't forget, if what I'm suggesting about this is true, they want to push vaccines because it's part of a wider agenda of stuff they're pushing. And they want to control the society in all the ways you're suggesting, because in actual fact, it's to do with warfare, as I've been saying all along. Now, that doesn't mean that people like, you know, if we're going to unpick every aspect of this, it can't just be that you're against everything that the government's doing. I mean, as you know, there's lots of people who are suggesting that this is all a plot by Bill Gates and the Chinese Communist Party to bring socialism to the US. Now, in actual fact, that's just wrong, in my view. What's going on here, this biological warfare program has been run by the West 4 years, and this is another 9/11, just like it. And it's actually warfare. People die. And of course, what the end result of what they want is what they intended was to trash the Chinese economy and then control the Western population through all the mechanisms which we've been discussing. In actual fact, they've failed, and they're going to lose World War III for all the reasons that I've been suggesting.
Well, one person who agrees with you, Martin, on the idea of this being a man-made bioweapon is a chap called Greg Felton. He's a journalist in Vancouver. We spoke to, I think it was in November, with his new book out called SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption, which we actually interviewed in the week before his book was printed. But anyway, I spoke to him again this week, and he is talking here about the proof that this is a man-made virus, which I think is absolutely key to taking this whole discussion on. Because, of course, if it is man-made, this is, seems to me, what is why they're tiptoeing around this. There are serious criminals out there that need to be hunted down for the hundreds of thousands of people that have died of COVID that maybe didn't need to at all. If it was man-made, who made it is the obvious question. But first, of course, you need to establish whether or not it was man-made. And this is what Greg Felton had to tell me this week about the proof that it is a man-made virus.
The one thing that is proof that this is not a naturally occurring virus is something called a furin cleavage site, which is in SARS-CoV-2. Now, to make a long story even longer, as Steve Allen used to say, a furin cleavage site is a genetic sequence in which there are four amino acids. The bookends of those four are basic amino acids of either histidine, lysine, or arginine. In the case of SARS-CoV-2, there are two arginines at the end of this cleavage site. Now, furin is an enzyme produced in the body, throughout the body, in multiple organs. It's very widely distributed. And furin will see a protein that has this kind of telltale, let's say, lock, and it is the key that opens the lock, for example. It will cleave the protein at the end of the fourth amino acid in that sequence. And by doing so, it energizes and primes the protein to work. Now, because the protein, the SARS-CoV-2 protein, has this sequence, it is cut. Because the furin is much more widely distributed in the body than other enzymes like cathepsin or trypsin, its effect on the human body is magnified many times. Now, coronaviruses do not have a furin cleavage site, except for MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, and that is of a different family than SARS-CoV-2, and frankly does not really factor into the discussion. SARS-CoV-2 belongs to the coronaviruses clade B, which is also the one that includes SARS. SARS does not have it. And there's no evolutionary mechanism by which SARS-CoV-2 could have acquired it in such a short space of time. It had to be inserted manually into the genome of SARS. Now, where it comes from is still not absolutely certain. However, there is a good case to be made that it was spliced in from HIV. And there are four Indian doctors, among others, like Birger Sørensen from Norway, who showed that there were these segments from HIV in SARS. And one of the four sequences that the Indian doctors pointed out happens to have a furin cleavage site. So it is much more plausible to argue that this HIV insert with a furin cleavage site is what has made the SARS virus SARS-CoV-2. And has given us an infection, a highly infectious but somewhat less lethal virus. What's also interesting is that the arginines in question of this cleavage site have a certain nucleotide sequence which is very rare. Now, for those of you who have never studied biology, an amino acid is a group of three nucleotides. Now, occasionally, there's more than one combination of nucleotides. Nucleotides of which there are only four. Now, one of the nucleotides that can create arginine is comprised of cytosine, guanine, and guanine. That's very rare. And there are two back-to-back in the furin cleavage site of SARS-CoV-2. Now, this is something that is sort of contrary to the notion that nature creates random mutations. And there are random mutations in amino acids. In fact, sometimes you can have a mutation on an amino acid that changes one nucleotide but does not change the amino acid. In some cases, there are about three different types of amino acids. And one of the composite compounds happens to be, in this case, CGG, which is very rare. So you have to ask yourself, how is it possible that these two very rare arginines could have come simply by nature? And frankly, it isn't really possible. Because of the furin cleavage site, one, and two, because of the rarity of the arginines in the furin cleavage site, there is very little evidence to suggest that there is a natural origin to this virus. Now, the trouble with truth statements in a culture like our culture is that there's always somebody prepared to say that's true, that's not true. What matters is how the evidence lines up. The evidence for a furin cleavage site being inserted artificially is overwhelming. There is no evidence, however, to suggest that there is any natural origin for this furin cleavage site. And for that reason, it is not possible to argue that SARS-CoV-2 is a naturally occurring virus.
Well, that's the author of SARS-CoV-2, or he, as he calls it, CoV-2, because it's the letter V, CoV-2. Contagion, Collusion, Corruption, Greg Felton from Vancouver. Martin, he's really trying to lay it out there absolutely clearly that because of this furin cleavage site, it can't just appear out of nowhere, out of nature, that there has to have been some sort of genetic modification. And of course, we know that there is billions and billions of hedge fund money, Pentagon money, etc., going into genetic engineering, much of which is doing things like this, adding this furin cleavage site in order to make something like a coronavirus far more deadly.
Well, it's what you were referring to earlier in the show as gain of function research, isn't it? Now, I tend to the view that it is definitely, in my mind, and I heard that with a great deal of interest. But of course, it's very difficult for me. I haven't got the background to argue whether he's right or wrong about this. It's the sort of stuff that needs peer review and all the rest of it. But to my mind, from a sort of political economy, political analysis point of view, we know that they're carrying out this kind of research because there's loads of evidence that that's what they're doing. I would argue they shouldn't be doing it at all. They claim that they're doing it because they're trying to develop complex biological agents so that if a complex biological agent came along, we could then deal with it. But of course, as he points out, that wouldn't happen in nature anyway. So it doesn't make any sense. But of course, if you're trying to develop weaponry, that makes perfect sense. And of course, we were talking earlier about non-symptomatic spread. That's what you designed the weapon to have. Yeah. So all of that sounds to me extremely interesting, and the book is probably worth people having a good look at.
I think the thing is, of course, that much of what he's talking there about arginines and RNA, about amino acids, etc., is something which, you know, it's biology. It's not something that somebody like Neil Ferguson, who's making these policies, a physicist, would actually understand. But it is something that anyone that's been involved in life sciences, biological science, and genetic engineering would understand extremely well. And which is why I thoroughly recommend Greg and his work, because what he's done is he's basically done a forensic investigation, which really we should have been seeing our wonderful state-run BBC doing a proper old-school documentary in, featuring people like Greg. with different points of view about what the origin of this all was. And that hopefully would start the process, because the criminal justice system seems to be totally shot, controlled by organized crime, to getting some criminal investigation and criminal prosecutions going as to who was actually behind this, who was funding this research, and who was actually doing research on these kinds of coronaviruses. But anyway, it's timed for our break. We're going to go off away from the subject of COVID-19 and take a look around the world in a minute. But first, we've got a bit of music, a double bill from, and this I thought it'd be interesting to hear these kind of pro-revolutionary songs, which were done in the 1990s. Actually, it's Bis, a song called Teensy Revolution from 1996, and followed by the Cuban Boys from 2000, Inertia Kicks.
Thank you.
First of all, Biss with Teensy Revolution from 1996, then the Cuban Boys and Inertia Kicks from 2000. I think it's the Secret Vampire Soundtrack EP the Biss one is from. Anyway, so both of them suggesting that upheavals might not necessarily be a bad thing. So maybe we could start our second hour, Martin. We're going to be talking about local news first, but the idea that maybe something positive can come from all of this, if there is some sort of mass upheaval because of COVID, a great reset, if you want to call it that, that there's something, actually something positive could come out of it all.
Well, I mean, the world changes faster or slower, and if positive things don't come out of it, then negative things will. And the only thing that can't happen is you can't go back and rerun the video.
Well, that's right. Okay, so local elections may be cancelled. I don't know if anyone has actually told people in Bristol this, but in Manchester they've been told anyway. BBC Radio Manchester has learnt that council and mayoral elections in May are likely to be postponed again over the COVID safety concerns. The government suggested they move to the summer, but Greater Manchester's leaders say it's more realistic to plan for autumn. Well, that's initially what they said last year, and of course there were no elections, so this is also rather going down the lines of looking at this as a police state, Martin, where we're not actually having any elections. Elections are for central government only, and local government, which of course has been being run down for years anyway, well, they're now saying, well, I'll tell you what, let's not just not bother with local elections, because it's not very much, it's a bit of a waste of money anyhow.
Well, also, of course, cancelling the elections to the Scottish and Welsh parliaments, although I don't think that decision, it'd be interesting to know if the British government decided to cancel those elections, whether they can. I suppose they can under current rules. Interesting if that was to happen. But of course, we've just had an election in the US with postal voting, controversial as that has been. And that is obviously the solution to having an election if you've got a lockdown. Everybody gets postal vote.
The Scottish and Welsh Parliament elections are still slated for May.
Yeah.
I'm just sharing this tweet from Kevin Fitzpatrick from BBC Radio Manchester talking about this. And he's a BBC reporter for the North West covering politics for Radio Manchester and BBC Northwest Tyne, I think that is, and he's also apparently a rugby league fan, which we, when we were at the BBC, we were always told, oh, you've got to be really into sport. And I said, well, I'm not into sport. I said, you've got to be. Well, I mean, how can you make me into sport? I think what they wanted was they wanted some sort of journalist to somehow embrace this whole idea. I mean, obviously, I enjoy playing sport, although I'm getting on now. I don't play so much as I used to. But I've never been a fan of football teams or rugby teams and, you know, that sort of thing. Anyway, I'm getting off the subject. But do you think we will or we won't have a local elections, Martin? What's your guess?
Well, I don't really know. But if they're going to go ahead in Scotland and Wales, you've got the question, well, why would you then not. I mean, they are scheduled anyway. And of course, in Bristol, we've had a year, you know, it was put off for a year. You can't keep on doing that. Ultimately, you have to have elections. And I would argue, as in the United States, if you've really still got in lockdown, and we may well be, then you've just got to have postal voting.
Yeah, you could also have safe voting in a with social distancing in a ballot box and using, you know, whatever, something to sanitize the ballots or something. There's no reason why you can't have a safe physical voting for people if they choose to do so.
Well, it's more difficult. It's more straightforward if you just move to postal voting. It really is.
But postal voting is also more open to fraud.
It's not really open to fraud if it's done properly. The idea that it's open to fraud. The reason why the right wing in the US were opposed to postal voting is because they're in general in favor of voter suppression anyway. They know that big turnouts tend to undermine the oligarchs' control of the system. And therefore, they pushed. And of course, one of the things Trump has done is he's massively increased the voter turnout across the US. And of course, a lot of it has been done with postal votes. The vote in Georgia, which was a runoff vote, which is very interesting, that's very rare in the US where you have a runoff vote. We don't have runoff votes in this country. It was brought in the 1980s in Georgia. And then, and of course, it's led to the situation where the Democrats have taken those two Senate seats and they will now have control of the Senate. But of course, traditionally, if you read Greg Palast's stuff, the Republicans have always been trying to prevent postal voting, to make it as difficult to vote as possible, so that it's only the kind of wealthy and suburban who will bother to turn up, and people living in poor communities who've got no fixed address and all the rest of it.
Well, one of the things I'd love to do is to have live people phoning in on our show in the future at some point. But anyhow, in the meantime, Fabrizio Nocivelli has tweeted in to say that in Xinjiang, the capital of Hebei province that surrounds Beijing, flights in and out have been cancelled today, according to Flight Radar 24, a day after the city of 11 million barred everyone from leaving. So it doesn't look as if the lockdowns in China have actually been as effective as you've been making out, Martin.
Well, as I said earlier, I've read about this earlier. They're locking down again, full on lockdown in a particular region, and everybody's going to be tested, which is what they did last time in Wuhan. Now, don't forget, if it is a war, then it's quite possible for somebody to come back in and reinfect them. And no doubt that's possibly on their minds.
OK, so let's have a listen anyway to, I suppose, move on to look at some other local stories. And one of the biggies for me, I mean, we did mention it briefly last year, which is the suicide of the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees's brothers, a tragic event, because particularly with the timing of it, which took place just after the it had been announced that Bristol was going into Tier 3 rather than opening up after the Halloween lockdown, the November lockdown. At the end of November, it was announced that Bristol was going into Tier 3. And the mayor's brother, who's a reformed criminal, he was in something called the Aggie Crew. I don't know if you know anything about much about them, Martin. He has, and I managed to trace it round to all the rest in peace messages on his Facebook page. So this has started as just a couple of people had told me in the street here in St. Paul's in Bristol about it. It's actually quite a big story round here. And of course, this is, in a way, it's the wrong story, isn't it? Because it's showing that someone who's a musician, he's a rapper, who was very much looking forward to getting back to work after the Halloween lockdown, and then to be told that actually, no, the lockdown's just going to be continuing, we're going into Tier 3, no music going on. This has an enormous actual effect. Of course, the wrong story is that lockdowns kill people too, Martin.
Yeah, they probably do, Tony, but the alternative is no alternative if you want to get rid of COVID. And, you know, you can't draw too much conclusions. I don't know the circumstances of this person's suicide, and nor do you, really. So you can't really make political capital out of it. It's just a sad event.
Martin, I'm not trying to make political capital. And I know you think I've got a vendetta against the mayor. Well, actually, no, I'm just a journalist doing my job. And I'm also reporting what is a big story down the streets. In fact, it's such a big story that there's an enormous mural being painted of Surplice, his real name being Martin Walker. And he was a musician who was part of the Aggie crew. And I thought, as a sort of tribute to Surplus, obviously there's loads of other musicians out there who've had a terrible time because of all of this, that we'd be nice to actually listen to some of Surplus's music. And this is one of his tunes. It's only fairly short, a couple of minutes, but as a rapper, I think he does a very good job. The Mayor's Brother should, I think, have got more, maybe a proper tributes to him. It may even have been that there have been memorial services and things like that. But anyway, here's Surplus with his song called Inner Life Epidemic.
So Bristing Surplus, Inner Life Epidemic. I show you what I'm not on, you get me? Yo. I'm fed up with the politicians, prejudicial tradition, coughing, reflecting the system, my reaction, rejecting a mission, all backing up the war effort that's on religion, fuck Catholicism, ain't there more to this now, Islam is hidden, I've had it up to ear with it, so I just thought rather than steering clear of it, I can stand up firm when I'm tearing it, and clear the mist with lyrical pit and clenching the fist, get near to this, the cynical's apprehending the myth, I bend and I twist, so when I rap it, render the riff, I'm spending it quick, at the edge of the end of the cliff, and they're sending us skits, like the government selling us shit, but then telling us it's Afghan and Yardi men in a mix, my adrenaline switch to defend my melanin quick. I think I'm going too far, not thinking when is it sick, cause I'm pissed enough to stab my pen in your wrist. I'm cool for back it if like sending for cliff, cause then it's a it. So while I still got the sight in both of my eyes, I pray for the will to go on in the form of a light. It's kinda hard to contain a storm in a mic. Some man a fraud and they blame us all of the time. It's more than a rhyme, it's sort of design. For linking up the goat to the grind, breaking every law to the borderline. Relocating your jaw to behind, leaving you sore to the spine. It's hard to ignore the sublime. I've never felt so isolated, and it's a lie to say it's safe through the fact that a boy's related. Am I right to say this? Proper definite mind for hatred. Some delegates repping, you stepping it, sign the paper, designed to fake us. Spit a prayer from mine to make her. I cried Jamaica, the foundator is my creator. What the rass can I say to the taker that's out for papers? Allies will save us as they try to lie for the latest. I'll admit it, I'm a child escapist. It's so explicit, and it's this British shit. Enough dick will deny the basic, but I try to face it. Stabbing knives in the eyes of Satan for the demise of hating, till I rise to the sky's adjacent. So while I still got the sight in both of my eyes, I pray for the will to go on in the form of a line. It's kinda hard to contain a storm in the mind. Some man a fraud and they blame us all of the time. It's more than a rhyme, it's sort of design. For linking up the goat to the grind, breaking every law to the borderline. Relocating your jaw to behind, leaving you short to the spine. It's hard to ignore the sublime.
So that's Surplus, rest in peace, Surplus, Bristol rapper and brother of Bristol's Labour Mayor Marvin Rees, who died at the end of November, believed to be suicide. Lots of rest in peace messages to him. Martin, what do you make of this inability of the press to look at the consequences of these lockdowns, though, in terms of human life?
The press have fairly covered this fairly well, Tony. We all know that lockdowns are not what people want, ideally, but we didn't want to go to war in World War II.
No, I'm not asking you about whether people want them. I'm saying that they have deathly consequences. This particular one is suicide, but there's also...
Well, you can't presume that he committed suicide because of the lockdowns.
There's a lot of people. Well, I didn't actually say that, but there's a lot of people who simply haven't received proper treatment through the lockdowns. They haven't received cancer treatment, etc., and they've died as a result as well.
Well, at the moment, the hospitals all over Britain are full of COVID patients and people who need to go in and have, you know, very important surgery for cancer and all sorts of other things can't go in. And that's the reality. And that's why that's why the government has U-turned and brought in the lockdown, even though their own right wing don't want a lockdown. And in fact, the ones who voted against on Wednesday, there's plenty more who really pushing that they've been forced back by the fact that the NHS really is on its last legs in this crisis. And that is a problem, isn't it? We should have locked down in March last year when we first heard about this in Wuhan, but we were too busy bollocksing on about Brexit.
Martin, we did lock down in March last year.
We didn't lock down soon enough. We missed 3 weeks there, which were vital. It's like at the beginning, it's like the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Martin,
the Americans knew there was going to be an attack on Pearl Harbor.
It doesn't matter how loud you
let it come in.
It doesn't matter how loud you shout. You're not going to change the fact that the virus was almost certainly here in Britain, November, December, January, and February, before you're saying we should have locked down. You can only lock down if you know that you've got a nasty virus around, like the Chinese did back in March. And then probably been in other parts of the world where it wasn't detected as it was in China, and it wasn't spreading.
We're talking about
COVID now. You're dragging this all back to COVID, but I'm really talking.
Well, you brought COVID in because you said it was the lockdown that caused this suicide.
The consequences of lockdowns in all sorts of ways. That's what I was talking about there.
Oh, well, that's COVID, isn't it? Lockdowns is COVID turning.
No, it's not, actually. Oh, right. It's about a death of a local musician.
Yeah, but you've linked it to lockdown, which I think is a non sequitur. He may have committed suicide because he couldn't go out to play his rap music, or he may have committed suicide for all kinds of reasons you don't know.
Now,
the Aggie crew that you mentioned are a criminal gang.
The Aggie crew were a criminal gang based around St. Paul's, where I live here in Bristol. And the name of the
people involved in criminal gangs commit suicide for all sorts of reasons.
The name of the gang. Well, he wasn't actually, Martin. The name of the gang is an abbreviation of aggravated burglary. They were jailed. Six of the gang members were jailed after being caught with more than £1 million worth of crack cocaine back in 1998.
Yeah,
and many of those people then came out of prison, including a guy called King Aggie, and have gone straight, you know, got all sorts of other careers out of that. So I'll put a little link up to, I'll certainly put a picture up of this marvellous, I think it's brilliant, mural to Surplus, which is in the St. Werburgh's Tunnel. And there are various others around the city, but that seems to be the biggest and the best one. And I'll also put up some links to the Aggie crew so you can find out, you know, how he managed to turn his life around from dealing crack cocaine here in the city. Other news in Britain, Martin, we've had seven men who were held after the oil tanker hijacking in the Solent to face no further action. Now, this strikes me as very strange. This has only been announced this morning, I think. The decision to drop the case was taken by the Crown Prosecution Service after additional maritime expert evidence came to light, which they don't really talk much about. So these guys took over an oil tanker in the Solent. They had to be arrested at gunpoint by the special boat service, and now they've all been told, oh, that's okay, you can walk free. I contrast this with what's happened to Assange, but this sounds incredible. The men, all from Nigeria, were detained by the British Special Boat Service after an incident on board the Nave Andromeda tanker on Sunday, October the 25th. Two men, Matthew John Okori, 25, and Sunday Sylvester, 22, had already been charged with an offence relating to conduct endangering ships under Section 58 of the Merchant Shipping Act 1995. But the Home Office criticised the decision to drop the prosecution by the Crown Prosecution Service. I find it incredible that you can hijack a ship and get away with it.
Well, that's the first I've heard. I mean, I've heard about the original hijacking, but the fact that they decided not to prosecute, it's the first I've heard of it. I can only presume it's probably... I'm just guessing that these people are essentially asylum seekers, like that guy that, you know, hung out in a plane and flew all the way from Africa. And ultimately they've looked at it and said, well, these guys are asylum seekers, and that's how we're going to treat them. And that's what's going on here. But I don't know.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because we don't know what's at the crux of this story, for the very reason that this decision has been made by the Crown Prosecution Service in secret, in a similar way to Keir Starmer, when he was the chief of the Crown Prosecution Service. He made decisions to quash the Surrey police prosecutions of Jimmy Savile, that they wanted to prosecute, and also aided the prosecution of Julian Assange, which he could have stopped as well when he was working in that job. It does seem to me that in a corrupt, disgusting, corrupt country, that whoever is in charge of as a chief prosecutor is one of the key people. If they're corrupt, then the whole country is corrupt, Martin. The criminal justice system is simply ineffective.
Well, I mean, individual decisions are obviously going, you know, it's often the Crown Prosecution Service doesn't prosecute because they don't think they've got a reasonable chance of conviction. Now, the particular cases you've referred to, Assange and Jimmy Savile and so on, no doubt politics is definitely involved in that. And of course, other similar figures in other countries, like Keir Starmer, who used to be the head of Director of Public Prosecutions here. You've got Balthazar Garzón, who was a prosecuting magistrate in Spain. He's taking a very close interest in the Assange case. And, of course, you've got Imposimato in Italy, who was the head of the Supreme Court there, whose brother was assassinated by the mafia. But he firmly pointed the finger in his book in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, to NATO. NATO intelligence services being behind all the terrorism in Italy since the 1940s.
So
that's not Keir Starmer, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. No. Isn't this the way corrupt powers work? We saw the same, didn't we, of course, with Hunter Biden over in Ukraine.
Yeah, well, I mean, don't forget, of course, I mean, criminals want to subvert the legal system. That is the way, you know, people have this idea of the mafia as some kind of, you know, thugs on the street. And of course, when I worked in Eastern Europe, it became quite clear that the mafia are, in fact, senior government officials with the power to decide on prosecution. And of course, that is the real struggle, is to root out that kind of thing. And of course, the illegalization of drugs in countries like Colombia are leading to a situation where the whole state structure, Uribe, who was the president of Colombia for many years, closely linked with Carlos Castano, the head of Auto Unidas Defensas de Colombia, the right wing paramilitaries, and it's all funded by drugs with the CIA.
Getting back to the Solent and the Nave Andromeda being hijacked on Sunday, October the 25th, I mean, I'd like to think that I could go and hijack an oil tanker and get away with it in the Solent, but I don't think I would. I don't know what was going on here, but it's one of the most important things about this, Martin, is the Home Office themselves have spoken out. And of course, the Crown Prosecution Service is a kind of joint thing between the Department for Justice and the Home Office. The Home Office themselves have spoken out saying how disappointed they are that this is not taking place. So there's obviously a bit of a rift going on here.
Yeah, well, I don't know what the reasons for this decision are, but I suspect it's possibly because these people were stowaways on the ship and were basically asylum seekers. And that, you know, that's possibly what's gone on here. But since I haven't looked into it, I'm not going to, you know, bet the farm on it.
Well, OK, so let's find out. I'm sure there'll be more coming out about that in the coming weeks. But if any of our listeners have got any more information about what was going on with that, it'd be interesting to hear. How do you get off, an assault from the Special Boat Service? Maybe the whole thing was an exercise. Who knows? We shall find out, I hope, on this program in coming weeks. Also, another story, UK story, Martin. Tasers have been used on primary school kids by West Midland Police. Three incidents involved children aged 10 and under, while a total of 150 alerts saw the weapon used on under 18s. Now, this is not what I believed the tasers were about. If you remember, Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset Police last year, when he was on this show, Martin, Andy Marsh was very much pushing, saying, well, tasers are perfectly safe. Well, of course, we know actually quite a few people have been killed by tasers, particularly people with pacemakers. Anyone who's got a heart condition can easily be killed by a taser. And now we hear that they're also being used against primary school children. And this is mail. They obviously done some sort of freedom of information request up there. 150 incidents. None of the three actually saw a taser fired, with all incidents involving non-discharge, such as drawing or aiming the weapons. But the overall number was up 38 usages recorded in 2018-2019. So the idea is that police are threatening children with tasers. And of course, you can bring, point it at a child. You can then press a little button on the taser where it starts to buzz an arc. So you get an electrical arc. So you're threatening the child to do something, and ultimately you can fire it.
Well, I would argue that that's a misuse of the weapon. Whatever you think of tasers, you shouldn't be using it to threaten primary school children or age children. I've done teach training, and we basically got the same sort of training that the police get with if you've got to deal with a child. And what we weren't taught how to do was to put them on the deck. The guy who explained it was a 2-day training course, and we were told, you know, we were taught how to deal with, you know, dealing with children who are out of control. And we were basically supposed to restrain them, but without putting them on the floor. And he said, if you were doing police training, they'd show you how to put them on the floor. But we're teachers, we don't put them on the floor. And that is what you're trained to do. And in fact, if you try and I work in schools, and if you don't stick to the system, then you are potentially open to prosecution. But for common assault,
the police seem to have total impunity when it comes to this. Six of these uses by West Midland Police involved actually discharging the taser at a child, either by firing the taser at the child or by making contact with the child with the electric current arc. So you can turn a taser on and you can actually press it into a child, rather like a cattle prod, in order to use it. So I'm really rather shocked to see the police using these so prolifically. 147 times it's been used apparently now in the last year against children. Are these actually helpful weapons for police to have? I mean, the police will argue, well, at least they're not guns.
Well, I mean, we've had people from the Police Federation on the show who've argued exactly that they're potentially useful and they're not dangerous or if not misused and so on. But I would argue that discharging a taser on a primary school aged child is a misuse of the weapon by any definition. And of course, we have the case here where a taser was fired by a WPC into somebody's face, which again, is completely.
Yeah, that's Rath Kumba, I believe. Yeah, he was actually a representative of the West Indian community for the police, and he had hit in the face by a taser. Unbelievable, really.
But you're not supposed to fire it in somebody's face. That's a myth. And you're not supposed to just fire it at random at people anyway. They're supposed to be last resort weapons. But if they're going to be turned in, I mean, I suppose the temptation, if you're a copper and you've got one in your hand, is, you know, it saves getting to grips with somebody. You can threaten them with it. And you know, that's why they're misused.
OK, so also another story, UK story this week, it stems from the BBC presenter Emma Barnett, who had been on Five Live. She took over Victoria Derbyshire's slot, and Victoria seems to be been shunted off into the sidings somewhere. Even though she's, in my mind, one of the best news presenters, journalists that we've seen on the BBC. She was earlier this week, she was due to interview somebody about the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, the weird thing about all this is that I think her name is Kelechnikov, actually that's a Twitter name, but she's a creator of Say Your Mind Pod, and also she's one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement. So she was sitting waiting to go on to Woman's Hour earlier this week when she tweeted that she was coming off of Woman's Hour because she's just had to witness absolutely something degrading and vile. The host, that's Emma Barnett, didn't realize her mic was on as she was talking about me before the interview started, and then she says that she was basically being talked about as, well, I won't use the word, but in very derogatory terms. So obviously, if you're about to be interviewed by someone who doesn't realize you can hear them, when she clocks the mic is on, suddenly it's, well, Kelechi, could you just explain to me, because I'm trying to give you a chance to opinion. To explain, it was on your producers to have explained and done their research. It was on you to check your mic. So she's really upset some black person. It's a white person who's interviewing somebody about Black Lives Matter being very condescending. So this is a bit of a not a very good way to start for Emma Barnett on Woman's Hour, Martin, by annoying the very person that she's trying to give a platform for. In fact, the reason she brought her on to interview her was saying, well, actually, the Me Too movement isn't actually really needed anymore.
Was it Me Too we're talking about, or Black Lives Matter?
It's Me Too. Sorry, yes, not Black Lives Matter. But this is also, a race issue, because this is a white, well-to-do BBC presenter interviewing a black woman about the Me Too movement and actually making derogatory comments that she didn't realise that their interviewee could hear.
Well, I mean, we all know that there is conscious and unconscious bias by, media, so-called media professionals. And in this case, it seems to have come out, and we're talking about it. But of course, if her mic hadn't been switched on, we wouldn't even know that was what was in her mind when she was carrying out the interview.
Yeah, the other thing to say about Emma Barnett, which I like to remind listeners of whenever I can, is she is not she is the sort of person that I did see in the early 90s arriving at the BBC who have a very arrogant attitude towards their job, like they have some sort of privilege to be there and everyone has got to listen to their every word. They don't really, I mean, Emma Barnett doesn't come across to me as a public service journalist. She's there, seems to just kind of feed her own ego. And the only what I'd say is that she is actually from a Manchester mafia family. Her father ran two brothels in Manchester, and there's quite a few people been tweeting for this US guest explaining to her that she was brought up by this gangster family that were running brothels in Manchester. Now, obviously, you know, it's quite feasible that she could go a different way, but it seems that she has kept this kind of arrogance that the mafia have, that they don't have to, or that they can talk about ordinary people in this patronising fashion. So I don't think the BBC should really be having people like Emma Barnett there. That was certainly not the sort of thing that I would like to see when I was there. We had a whole load of, I thought, very professional broadcasters that were slowly pushed out by the likes of Emma Barnett.
Yeah, well, I understand. Although her family had this rather dodgy background. I don't know if you could call it mafia. But
running brothels is that exactly that?
Yeah, but it depends whether they're were they ever prosecuted?
Well, no, they basically were paying off police. That's what's for, yeah. And it was a prosecution eventually.
Okay, but I mean, she in fact went to private school, didn't she? What the mafia do? What the Russian mafia did years ago is they send all their kids to Eton College. In fact, Eton College is full of mafia from all over the world. The kids of the mafia.
Right.
We're talking about Hunter Biden earlier. Yeah, this is what we're talking about.
And also the Beverly Hills estates of Britain, these really posh private housing estates. I was visiting one in Bromley, actually. Had a walk around there, and there's another one. Well, there's various of them around, aren't there, these private gated estates. Chatting to somebody there who said, well, this place used to be great until the mafia turned up. So there's lots and lots of mafia money in private gated estates, and it's obvious why they want gates. They don't want anyone snooping up what their criminal activities are.
Well, that's right. And as I mentioned, the international drugs trade earlier, it's totally enmeshed with the state and the Western intelligence services. And it has been for years.
OK, so let's go around and look at some other things around the world now, having looked at the Bristol, a bit about the UK. In South Korea, they are pushing the Iran to release a seized oil tanker. Well, we had another story about an oil tanker in the Solent a minute ago. It does seem as if the tanker wars are starting. Maybe it's a good idea to get your wind generator on your roof if these oil supplies are going to run out, and maybe get an electric car. It does seem as if this is all sort of hanging around in the background as all this push for green technology. You know, that may be why they're doing it. It's because they're going to cut the oil supplies at some point soon. So South Korea is pushing the Iranians to release a seized oil tanker. The vessel was impounded by Tehran amid talks with Seoul over $7 billion in blocked funds. So the Iranians, Martin, here are being fairly smart. They're saying, well, if you won't give us our money back, we won't give you your tanker back.
Yeah, and as Pepe Escobar has pointed out, all that the Iranians have to do to close the Strait of Hormuz is to threaten to carry on this kind of harassment of oil tankers going through it. And then the insurance companies will not insure you to send an oil tanker through the Gulf. So without a shot being fired, they can just close it down. And that's what, if they have to, that's what they'll do. And this is them, you know, gradually escalating in response to all the attacks that have been made on them, including the assassination of Soleimani this time last year.
And the nuclear scientists, etc. So it looks like the Iranians are starting to find their feet, getting a bit more confident.
Well, no, I think they're in a desperately desperate situation. They're having a really bad COVID war. The head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, after Khomeini, immediately said as COVID broke out in Iran that we suspect that this is a biological warfare attack on us. So they've already picked up on that. They were picked up on that immediately. The Iran is in a very difficult position. because they've got massive sanctions on them. They can't get medical supplies that they need as a result of Pompeo and Trump. And of course, Trump was basically pushing for an attack on Iran, but he was persuaded not to do it by wiser heads inside the US military. He said, well, if you do that, we're going to lose loads of casualties, because, of course, they would. It would be devastating for Iran. It would be devastating for the whole region, devastating for the world. But while we are, you know, getting on with our business, all this stuff has been still hasn't gone away.
It certainly is. I wonder, because we're going to hear the about the storming of the Capitol building in a minute. But Martin, do you think there's going to be any change in this policy towards Iran and the Middle East generally with a change of president?
Well, I think the Iranians openly said to their various allies in the Middle East that whatever the provocation, nobody was to respond, because they are hoping that Biden will not be as inveterately hostile to them as Trump has turned out to be, and as the Israelis always are. And it would be foolish for the Iranians, they know this, to retaliate openly against the provocations to which they're being subjected. If it gives Trump between now and next week a chance to launch a war against them. But Biden, I'm afraid, is in the pocket of the same military-industrial complex as Trump. Ultimately, folks, it doesn't really matter who the US president is, because they're the people behind the scenes who decide what the policy is.
Well, you're suggesting it's not really a democracy.
No, it isn't, Tony. In actual fact, modern Russia is far more democratic than the modern United States. You've got a full spectrum of political forces in Russia, from far left to far right, and they have not first-past-the-post elections. There's going to be a parliamentary election in Russia in September, and probably you're going to get United Russia sweep. Not, they will be the dominant party, but there will be parties to their left and to their right, and there will be a sensible debate. And of course, in the US, you've got two parties which are both controlled by the same military-industrial complex and Wall Street, and it doesn't matter who you vote for, they're going to run the show. And of course, modern Russia has actually been through a totalitarian system, and therefore people are very conscious of the fact that that things can be manipulated. Okay. Whereas in the US, people pride themselves on their freedom, and in actual fact, they haven't got any at all because the system's rigged against the ordinary person.
Well, I'd be interested to see what you make of the storming of the Capitol building, Martin, because we're going to hear now the ITV news report, which I think was one of the best. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page, to their YouTube of it, as Trump supporters storm the building.
This is exactly what was feared, but in no way is this a surprise. It has been fueled by the president's rhetoric, and it's increasingly clear this election has not healed the wounds, it has simply amplified them.
We followed the aggrieved and infuriated Trump supporters as they stormed the building.
I swear to CNN, and they just said he's dead.
Through broken windows and doors they had forced open.
Purpose of storming Congress itself?
Because they work for us. They don't get to steal it from us. They don't get to tell us we didn't see what we saw.
We respect the law. We were good people. The government did this to us. We were normal, good, law-abiding citizens, and you guys did this to us. We want our country back. We are protesting for our freedom right now. That's the difference. It's normal.
And so here we are right now inside the halls of Congress. This is exactly what so many anticipated, and yet the Capitol Hill police are doing their best, but failing to control the situation.
We all know that they changed the rules mid-game, and they're not being held accountable, and that's a shame.
What's your message to them?
In the galleries, people took shelter. The great constitutional showdown in Congress had to be suspended. 100 miles away in Delaware, President-elect Joe Biden pleaded for the intervention of the one man who could halt this.
I call on President Trump to go on national television now to fulfill his oath and defend the Constitution and demand an end to this siege, to storm the Capitol, to smash windows, to occupy offices, the floor of the United States Senate, rummaging through desks, on the Capitol, on the House of Representatives, threatening the safety of duly elected officials. It's not protest. It's insurrection.
Indeed, amid the chaos of this afternoon, shots were fired, and one protester badly wounded. The circumstances are not clear, but it is proof of how perilous it remains here tonight. This morning, the president spoke to the crowd in front of the White House, repeating his false claim that the election was stolen.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
The cost of that rhetoric is increasingly clear. As crowds tonight are still swirling around Congress, and America's long journey as a stable democracy appears to be in genuine doubt.
Well, that's ITV, genuine democracy. Well, we started out the bit before that report in talking about how it wasn't a genuine democracy. Martin, what to what extent do you think that this is a genuine event here? You know, could these protesters who actually, although there were some violent people in the crowd, they were largely peaceful. Surely the authorities could have prevented them getting in.
Well, that's the big question. And of course, all of the police officers who are in charge of the policing have all resigned because they shouldn't have got anywhere near the building. I mean, you know, and you could argue that Trump shouldn't have a rally to try and pressurize the Congress, you know, but at the same time, you could say, OK, they're not happy. Let them have a rally, just like in Belarusia or anywhere else. If you're not happy with the result, yes, you can protest, but you're not supposed to storm the building and smash the place up. And four people are now dead. There was the one woman who was shot dead by the police. There's a police officer's dead. And there's three other people who've also, I think it's five now, three other people have also died from heart attacks or whatever. Now, the way you deal with that is you just make sure they can have their protest, but you can't go in the building. And that didn't happen. Why not? Well, now, there's actually video footage of the police letting them into the building. And also, of course, later on, when they'd lost control of the situation, they're even trying to talk them out of the building and being friendly with them and so on. But at the same time, also somebody ends up getting shot. I mean, it's basically chaotic. And of course, what would have happened and what did happen when it came to the vote is the various people who wanted to vote against the Electoral College vote, they were a minority and they were voted down. And then that was always the way it was going to be. Now, we could discuss, you know, going back to the election, what was that all about? But I mean, that's, you know, what happened yesterday. It's a massive failure of policing.
It is. And I'm always questioning things like this, particularly after similar events in Kiev back in, was it 2015, 2014? Yeah. These sorts of events are surely designed to put political pressure on.
Yeah. But I mean, we shouldn't jump to conclusions about anything, especially events like this. I mean, I've been reading all sorts of stuff from all different angles about this since it happened. And you've got some conservative US commentators saying that in actual fact, the crowd had been infiltrated by the left wing, the Antifa were in there and, you know, and all the rest of it. These people and there may be crisis actors and so on. But don't forget, there was a massive rally. Trump had got a lot of people there, mostly from out of state. So they'd flown there or driven there. They're not from Washington, D.C. itself. It's a strongly democratic city. Yeah.
But look, let me just talk about the population. We heard
they are the people.
One of the things I'd point out is that we heard. I think it's Michael Mates. I'm not sure who the ITV reporter was, but he was putting things out of sequence. So what he did rather naughtily in that report was that he had a clip of Biden saying, "Oh, that, you know, the president mustn't encourage the protesters," and then afterwards he had a previous speech by Donald Trump, which was at the beginning of the rally, saying, "Oh, we're not going to just simply accept this result, blah blah," and he put those in actually chronologically in the opposite order, so it makes it look as if Trump was saying that as a response to Biden. Actually, the fact of the matter is Trump, as soon as things started turning nasty, was trying to calm the situation down by saying, you know, look, go back home, everybody. And yet he was, at that point, he'd been taken off of Twitter.
Well, don't forget, he spoke for 75 minutes at the rally. And at the end of it, he said, now you need to march down to the Capitol. Now, he shouldn't have done that. He should have said, here we all are, we're against this, blah, 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 now it's time to go home. But he didn't say that. Having wound them up for 75 minutes, he said, now it's time to go down to the Capitol and support our representatives.
Well, that's right. And I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do, to stand outside and make a lot of noise.
You know, they didn't stand outside, did they? They stormed the building.
No, well, some would argue that they were allowed into the building, Martin. Yes. This is what I'm trying to say here.
This is the questions that's going to have to be asked. The senior police officers, I understand that the Capitol has its own police force, yeah, just for looking after the Capitol building. And in actual fact, other law enforcement were saying, look, you've got to be prepared that these people might try and come and storm the building. And they took the view that that's not going to happen and we're just going to, you know, treat it as a normal day. Now, that there will have to be some kind of inquiry into this.
Well, but yeah, already, okay. So already, I think we just have to really raise the possibility that these protesters were somehow facilitated rather than stopped from getting in. It doesn't seem to me to be rocket science to stop protesters getting in when you've got loads of police and you've also got these massive black iron railings that could have been put in the way to stop them. But anyhow, so I thought I'd ask a Canadian what he made of all of this, because I spoke to Greg Felton just after all this was unfolding, the investigative journalist from Vancouver, and I asked him what he thought about this, because it is almost like a kind of stage coup attempt type of thing. But obviously it wasn't a coup, but the idea was to put political pressure on at the moment of the ratifying of the Electoral College votes by the Congress. So let's have a listen now to what Greg Felton had to say about this whole business with Trump this week.
This has almost become a comic opera. I think there are two issues at stake here. One is that Donald Trump has no real allies anywhere, and that both parties want to get rid of him as quickly as possible. I mean, at one time we had the Republican Party, now we have the Trumpublican Party. And the Trumpublicans and the Republicans do not get along. I mean, I have no respect whatever for Mitch McConnell. I mean, he's one of the worst offenders, worst members of the Congress I can imagine. But he himself is realizing that there is a limit to which anybody can support Donald Trump, and he's prepared to let Joe Biden take over the presidency. There is a split between the radical, I would probably say a little bit the pejorative way, the knuckle-dragging, sort of uneducated, knee-jerk, right-wing zealots who see Donald Trump as a sort of savior or some quasi cult leader, that they want him back, they want him to stay in power. And those who were at least possessed of a basic political sensitivity. I mean, I think there is quite possibly a case to be made that some of the election results in some states weren't exactly accurate. I don't know enough to say, because what we get from the press is very one-sided. But I think what happened to Trump is that he lost the benefit of the doubt. I mean, Trump has committed so many acts of outrageous stupidity that he has a national and international embarrassment. But there is, I think, no willingness even to want to count to entertain the notion that there was something wrong with the election. I think people want to get rid of him as quickly as possible, put Biden in, because Biden's essentially a domesticated house pet, too. He'll do whatever Israel tells him. He's an emasculated sock puppet, like everybody in the Democratic Party, which is Israel's natural governing party in the United States. And Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who is a horrible choice for vice president, will be Israel's governors on the Potomac for the next 4 years. And so it doesn't matter which party wins. Israel is always the person who chooses the government, to all intents and purposes. And so it's not in anybody's interest to keep this loose cannon from firing off in the White House any longer than necessary. Again, Trump might have a case, but nobody really cares enough to want to do anything about it. And Trump has shot himself in the foot so many times, he can't walk a straight line.
So do you think there will be any real big changes in foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, with Biden?
No. I think Biden may be slightly more willing to adhere to some measure of diplomacy and rational governance. But there's going to be no hope in hell that Israel is going to have to worry about disobedience from its loyal satrap on the Potomac. There's going to be little change. And as I stated in my first book, The Host and the Parasite, the United States, to borrow Pat Buchanan's famous phrase and paraphrase it slightly, is Israeli-occupied territory. And it has been since 1948.
Oh, that's Greg Felton, and the author of The Host and the Parasite, and also this book on SARS-CoV-2 being a bioweapon of some sort, or at least man-made. Martin, what do you make of what he had to say there?
I broadly agree with that. I think that's what you've got to understand is that most people don't really understand the workings of the American electoral system. So the president, as we know, is not directly elected. In Russia or France, there's a presidential election. And if you don't get or Ecuador or you get a presidential election, if you don't get 50% of the vote in the first round, you have to go to a second round with the two highest people competing against each other. Yeah. So it's not proportional, but it's at least there's two rounds. In the September election coming up in Russia, it'll be a proportional vote, as in many European countries. So that's why you get a full spread of political parties in Russia, from the Communist Party on the left to the neo-fascists on the right. But they'll all be represented according to how the votes crack up in the country. In the US, the reason for the Electoral College is to prevent. I mean, the people who designed the US Constitution designed it to be not democratic. So we have votes, a bit like in the Roman Empire or the Roman Republic, but we don't want a straight vote where one poor person's vote is the same as one rich person's vote. So that's why you have the Electoral College, because it means that each state, all of the votes of that state go to one side or the other, which means that you can quite frequently, as Trump did in 2016, he won the presidency with 3 million less votes than Hillary Clinton. That can't happen in Russia. That can't happen in France. The other thing, of course, is that the Senate is based on having two senators for each state because it's a federal state. Now, in actual fact, that means that small states like Vermont can have two senators. Bernie Sanders is one of them. But great big states like California, with millions of people, they only get two senators. So it's actually quite an achievement for the Democrats to have taken the Senate as they did on Wednesday. They've now got a 50-50 split, and Kamala Harris becomes the deciding vote.
Well, I mean, in this country, Martin, we had big movements like the Chartists, etc., to try and make the electoral system fairer. It doesn't seem like they're really up to speed in the US.
Well, don't forget, in Britain, we've still got a situation, unlike any other country in Europe, where the current Tory government has a majority of 80 in Parliament, but only got 43% of the vote. So in actual fact, the two countries which stand out as having non-democratic setups is Britain and the United States.
Well, the other reason it's undemocratic here in the UK is that we don't have any kind of elected head of state. We've had this Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family as our heads of state centuries.
That's right. Democracy, so-called, in Britain has evolved from a feudal setup. And when the US was set up in 1776, they took a more radical version of our setup and planted it there. But it was radical for the 18th century. Yeah, only men of property get to vote. There's an electoral college to make sure that we don't just have a straight vote for the president. The Senate is set up to make sure that rural voters from conservative voters get more say than urban voters. And of course, in the Congress itself, which the Democrats still just about control, what's happened is that the Republicans have, if you look at the electoral districts in the US, that's where gerrymandering comes from, because they look like reptiles with lots of sticky out bits and so on. And this is all designed to make sure that poor and particularly black voters get all piled into one constituency. Same thing happens in the inner cities in Britain.
Like I said just now, it's like the rotten boroughs here, isn't it? But look, what about Trump? Do you think that we've seen the last of him? I mean, he's certainly banned from Facebook and Twitter now.
Yeah, but that's just a political spite by or fear by people like Zuckerberg and so on. Trump isn't going to be the president, but he's going to have a very important influence in US politics going forward. I mean, if he was a more decent human being, I mean, I was in a class this week where we this all came up on News Round, and we're talking about 8, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, and they're not very bright. This is a special school. But the one of the kids I was working with said, well, can't Trump just go away and have another go next time? And it's like, it's obvious even to an 8-year-old that's what you do. If you've lost, you've lost. That doesn't mean that you've lost forever. That's the whole point about democracy. You can go away, have a think about it, and come and have a go next time. But the problem for the Republicans now is that, as pointed out by our Canadian colleague, is that Trump is such a powerful figure that he will basically undermine the Republican attempt to move back into the centre ground. And under a first-past-the-post setup, that could lead to a situation where the Democrats begin to control everything.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, so I thought I'd ask Greg, though, also, final clip with him, about the future, and particularly about the Great Reset, about Klaus Schwab. And it was a conversation which led on to discuss the legitimacy of the United Nations, but particularly the legitimacy of the State of Israel, because this is a question which we're constantly told, Martin, is anti-Semitic to even raise it. But is it?
No, it's not. I mean, let's put it this way. Spain doesn't recognize Kosovo as an independent state, because if it did, and that's why the EU officially doesn't recognize it as an independent state, because if it did, they might have problems internally and so on and so forth. Kashmir is not recognized as an independent state, even though it's quite clear that the majority, if there was a referendum, which was promised in 1948, would vote to be an independent of India.
Okay.
The State of Israel was set up on the understanding that it would be within certain boundaries, mostly along the coastal strip of what is now Israel, and they were to stay in those boundaries. Now, if you come outside those boundaries, you're no longer a legitimate state, just like Hitler invading Poland.
Well, this is one of the things that Greg pointed out to me, and I'll put a complete version of this long interview, 45 minutes altogether, with Greg Felton. We'll only be hearing a few clips from it at the moment on this show, but that will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But let's hear now from Greg Felton on the Great Reset, Klaus Schwab, the UN, and Israeli legitimacy.
I don't really want to trust Schwab. To me, anybody of his power is something that should cause people concern. I do, however, not like the United Nations. I think the United Nations should be disbanded. The United Nations was a failure from the start as far as an entity to promote world security. As far as economics goes, it's always been strapped for cash, and the United States is the biggest delinquent of the entire membership, because it will not fund the United Nations properly, because it doesn't think the United States doesn't think it has to adhere to any authority beyond itself. It's the American exceptionalist mentality that has rendered the United Nations somewhat suspect as an effective organization. So when the World Economic Conference comes calling and says, "Hi, United Nations, we'll give you a ton of money if you be our partner," and I kind of think the United Nations is sold out. So yes, it's sold out to the World Economic Forum, and so we're going to have the UN becoming, I would suggest, an enforcement arm of the World Economic Forum, the way it became an enforcement arm of NATO in the United States in the 1990s during the illegal overflights, no-fly zones, I mean, over Iraq. I mean, the United Nations has been an impotent debating chamber for the entire 70-odd years that Israel has been persecuting Palestinians. Rarely has the United Nations spoken up in defense of Palestine. And even when it does, it doesn't have any effect. I mean, the United Nations membership recognizes Palestine, but it hasn't got a seat in the General Assembly. I mean, you can't have, it's sort of Eisenberg's exclusionary principle. You can't have two things occupying the same space. And so either Israel has to go or Palestine does, and I can prove that Israel is not legitimate as a state and is not even a bona fide member of the United Nations. So quite frankly,
how can you prove that? Would you just like to flesh that out a bit? How do you know, what do you mean by that?
Well, the United Nations admitted Israel as a member in 1949, I believe. I got to check the year. It was the only country ever admitted conditionally. It was admitted provided that it returned to Palestinians all monies and property stolen and allow Palestinians to live peacefully in their own land. Essentially, Israel had to promise to be a law-abiding state. And of course, it hasn't. It has violated the terms of admission. And because of that, it is not a member in good standing of the United Nations. Because it has not lived up to its terms of admission, it can be expelled physically overnight. There does not need to be a resolution of the General Assembly or the Security Council, because this is a membership issue. It does not concern the Security Council. So Israel is an illegitimate country since it had no right to steal Palestine from the Palestinians, and leaving aside all the nonsense about the Holocaust, I mean, as H.G. Wells said, the UN had no authority to take land from one party and give it to another. It's just not possible.
When would you suggest that stealing of the land took place? Was it mainly the Six-Day War?
Oh, no, long before that. No, actually, land had been stolen going back to the beginning of the 20th century with the Aliyah, the movement of European Jews to Palestine. But it happened in earnest in a major way in November 29th, 1947, which is the year that the moment that Israel invaded Palestine under Plan Dalit to dispossess the Palestinians. And because of that, almost 800,000 Palestinians were removed from their land by invading Jews. And what's even more interesting about this, that Walter Eitan, who was a member of the Zionist Agency at the time, said the figure was closer to 800,000, but the official history books say it's about 700,000. Israel had no legitimacy. Harry Truman, President of the United States in March of 1948, was prepared to rescind U.S. support for the partition plan, which began November 29th, 47, which arbitrarily divided Palestine into Arab and non-Arab sectors, because he knew that it could not be carried out without severe injustices done to the Palestinians. Harry Truman did not want to go down in history as being a party to a war crime. So he was threatening to withdraw American support because he knew what was happening. And in fact, if you go back to history, the British mandate of Palestine had not expired by the time David Ben-Gurion declared statehood.
Yeah, so that's Greg Felton there talking about, a little bit about Klaus Schwab, but mainly, Martin, about the idea that Israel shouldn't really exist as a state under the terms of the United Nations.
Yeah, that's right. And arguing about that is a political argument, just as whether Kosovo should get a seat at the United Nations, or Kashmir, or South Sudan, or United Ireland, whatever it may be. And to say that it should or shouldn't exist, some people believe it should. I'm basically of the argument that the agreement was made, very succinctly by our Canadian colleague, that they were only recognised on the basis that they would stay within certain boundaries. They shouldn't have been recognised even within those boundaries, I would argue. But once you've agreed that that's what's going to do, the Soviet Union agreed, and the Truman eventually agreed, because he was under pressure from electoral pressure from Zionist forces within his own party. But once you've, after that, the Six-Day War was a land grab. The seizure of the Golan Heights was a land grab. The invasion of Lebanon is unprovoked aggression. At that point, you say, right, you can't be a member of the United Nations anymore. Now, coming back to the question of whether the United Nations should or shouldn't exist, I think our colleague there is throwing out the baby with the bathwater. What should happen is that Israel should be given the straightforward ultimatum. You get back behind that green line of 1948, otherwise you're not going to be recognised as a state. And it's no, and that's saying that the state of Israel will no longer exist in international law. And that means that anybody, you know, you become an outlaw. And of course, if the US president was strong enough, that's what they should do. Because, of course, the Israeli state depends massively on US taxpayers' money. Greg, that's what pays for all the happy middle class lifestyle of the settlers in the West Bank is US tax dollars.
Greg Felton is working as a teacher of English as a foreign language, even though he's a trained investigative journalist. I think it's, you know, the elephant in the room here is that where there are opinion formers, journalists who are critical of Israel, they find themselves out of their job. Peter Mandelson, I can remember years ago, boasting about the idea that if there was a journalist around that he didn't agree with, he would just phone the boss up and have them sacked. He's Lord Mandelson, of course, very close to the Rothschild family. Now, Martin, I do wonder about this because there seems to be a quite active campaign, probably over 20 years or more, to get journalists who are critical of Israel just simply removed from their jobs on a blacklist.
Well, that's definitely what's going on. I mean, the dogs in the street know that's what's going on. Interestingly enough, there's a letter in The Guardian today, and a report has just been put out by various senior barristers and Supreme Court judges saying that the British universities cannot and should not be forced to adopt this definition of anti-Semitism, which has been foisted on the Labour Party by the Israeli embassy using US tax dollars. Now, ultimately, I would argue that the state of Israel has got no more right to brutalise the Palestinians than the government in Serbia had the right to brutalise the Muslims in Bosnia or Kosovo. And don't forget, we went to war with the Serbians over Kosovo. We bombed them for 73 days and killed thousands of civilians, but they didn't get Kosovo. And you know who didn't support NATO intervention in Yugoslavia? Ariel Sharon, the Prime Minister of Israel, because he realised that that's exactly what could happen to the Israelis. If you are going to use air power against the people in Gaza, maybe it's time for the RAF to start shooting down your aeroplanes.
On the subject of blacklists, there's a fantastic article in Forbes, which I hadn't come across, but I think it's almost a year ago, February 2020, but it's absolutely fascinating about how academic blacklists impede serious work on climate science by a guy called Roger Pielke, P-I-E-L-K-E, as the contributor. Climate advocacy group called Skeptical Science hosts a list of academics that it has labelled climate misinformers. The list includes 17 academics and intended as a blacklist. We know of this intent because the principal of Skeptical Science, a blogger named Dana Nucciti, said so last Friday, writing one academic on their list. If you look at the statements we catalogued and debunked on her page, it should make her unhirable in academia. So the so-called unhirable academic is Professor Judy Curry, formerly the chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Tech, fellow of both the American Geophysical Union and American Meteorological Society. By any conventional academic metric, Curry has compiled an impressive record over many decades. The idea that she would be unhirable should be laughable, but there's nothing funny about Skeptical Science. Curry should be a senior statesperson in the atmospheric sciences community. Instead, she's out of academia. She attributes that in part to being placed on the Skeptical Science blacklist. I asked, he says, Professor Curry about the situation. She explained, in 2012, I was informed by my dean that the administration wanted me to step down. There were several reasons. One was extreme displeasure by several activist climate scientists who had a direct pipeline to the dean. So, I mean, this is interesting. I mean, we talked last year, didn't we, about Norman Dodds, famous. He was around in the 1980s, getting on as an old man in the United States. And some fascinating interviews by him, Martin, where philanthropists, we're talking there about the Carnegie Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, had decided that they would fund stables of, what they called stables, like horses' stables, of academics who would be pushing their version of particular disciplines in the universities. And of course, this has only got worse as universities have been privatized over the years.
Yeah. I mean, there's always been struggles in academia between different views of various things, even things that people outside academia would regard as not, you know, not worth arguing about. But of course, you know, people's careers and self-regard depend upon being right and all the rest of it. I would argue, just like we were talking about media and pharmaceuticals earlier, universities should be public bodies, publicly funded, without money coming from private sector, and they should have a wide spectrum of opinion regarded as legitimate within them. But it, within any discipline, there's going to be people saying, well, you know, you're on, you know, the more marginal your position is, the more likely it is you ain't going to get hired. That's true in any kind of work, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And Judith Curry is now president of the Climate Forecast Applications Network. So that is outside academia now. So she was effectively forced out of her job by these people, even though she's doing some work in climate science. She's also one of those, Martin, who's been circulating the story we were dealing with earlier in the first part about a lab leak hypothesis, you know, scientists hotwiring viruses in hopes of preventing a pandemic. It seems to me what we've got here is we've got a kind of split going on in journalism and academia, with those that are prepared to say anything to keep their jobs and basically be part of a clique. They do very well, whereas anybody that's got an independent mind, it gets the sack and it finds himself on the dole driving buses or cleaning offices.
Well, I mean, these struggles are eternal. They've been going on for a long time. And even in the best of all possible worlds, there is going to be disagreements about stuff. Academic disagreements, they should be regarded as normal. I mean, a university should have a variety of different. I mean, for example, I don't like Niall Ferguson, the epidemiologist or physicist,
the
historian. I don't like his political views at all. I find them reprehensible. He's basically pro-imperialist. He believes empires are good. The British Empire was good and the US Empire is good. But his books are extremely well researched and very readable. And, you know, I've got no problem at all with him being a professor of history, even though I disagree with him fundamentally on his politics. And I think that is what universities should. And of course, there's got to be other people who in the university who don't agree with it.
The thing is, you have to have a spectrum of opinion in order to foster critical thinking, surely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But of course, you can't just argue that you've got a right to a job. You know, you've got actually, I mean, this is what peer review
well,
is.
Well, no, but I mean, what we're saying here, Martin, we're talking here about blacklisting of people of particular points of view. I think that's different to saying that, you know, this woman, June, has got a right to a job. But, you know, there is a pressure being put on both in broadcasting, I mean, probably in political parties too, but most importantly, broadcasting and universities to only have one point of view, which seems to me to be.
Or rather, it's not one point of view, Tony. You can't be outside the consensus that, you know, that is the Overton window. Yeah. It's not. There's a kind of pretense of allowing different points of view when that's not really what's going on. And of course, the other thing is, ultimately, we've got a stock market that's rigged using taxpayer funds to create massive wealth for those at the top of the pile. They then take that wealth and set up university chairs, fund think tanks, and they because they're siphoning money off in this scam at the top. They then got people like Gates, who had a quote from earlier. I mean, he basically is he's called a philanthropist because he funds loads of university research, etc., etc. But in actual fact, he's not a philanthropist. He's a disaster capitalist.
Yes.
with a massive fund slush fund.
It just so happens sitting next to me is a book called Blacklist, The Inside Story of Political Vetting by Mark Collingworth and Richard Norton Taylor, back when journalism was journalism. I think this is from the possibly even the 1980s, this book. Yeah. But there was a fascinating chapter in this called The Christmas Tree Files, yeah, which is all about MI5 and the BBC. So anybody that had a view that they didn't like at the BBC had a Christmas tree stamped on their BBC file as a sort of secret code, so people would know that they were lefties, the Christmas tree being, of course, the red flag, the song for the red flag. And then they would be removed. They would find an excuse to sack them.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, the dogs in the street know that this is what goes on. But of course, some people like John Pilger, for example, or the late Robert Fisk, they get a reputation by calling this stuff out. So the struggle goes on in every generation.
Yeah. And on YouTube, it's being censored anyway. So let's go and have a listen now, because, I mean, this is a sort of cult that's developing here, I think. You're only allowed to think one thing in academia and journalism. And I thought we'd just have a listen to a chap called Ed, who's an elder in the Jehovah's Witnesses. And I spoke to him last week just generally about what the Jehovah's Witnesses are and how they first started.
The Jehovah's Witnesses started round about the 1870s. And it was with a chap called Charles Taze Russell in America. And he was like part of the Millerite movement. And there were, as you probably know, there were probably a lot of break-offs between the Millerite movement, and there were lots of people forecasting end-of-the-world dates and things like that. And he was one of them. And he started to print a magazine called the Herald of Christ's Presence with a watchtower. And that's how he came to be. And he printed with a chap called Barber, and then they sort of fell out over different doctrines, and so he went on his own.
Well, I know there's a lot of Freemasonry in the United States. Were these people Freemasons?
It's got quite a link towards the Masons. Charles Taze Russell had beliefs that you would be akin to Masons. You know, he was into pyramidology and things like this, and the measuring of certain pyramids represented some things. Some of the things, like the 1914 date, he got from the measuring of a pyramid, because Jehovah's Witnesses believe 1914 is an absolute date for them of when Jesus became king in heaven, invisibly.
Okay, so there's a kind of timetable, it sounds to me, that there's almost mathematically working out of various timetables to do with the way that history is going to unfold.
Yeah, there is. They came up with all manner of dates before the 1914 date. they forecast certain dates in the 1870s. He forecast 1913 at one point, but then didn't realise there was no year naught, because it goes from 1 CE to 1 BCE. So he adjusts it to 1914, but he took that measurement from the pyramid. And then later on, when that didn't happen as they thought it was going to happen, they then introduced other dates, 1925, for instance, and then a chap called J.F. Rutherford, he took over as the president, and then he forecast different dates as well, all the way through, actually, this last century.
There seems to be quite a lot of teaching to do with the end of the world in the Jehovah's Witness. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly it. When a Jehovah's Witness knocks on your door, they are basically wanting you to become a Jehovah's Witness, obviously. You know, they want to have a Bible study with you, but they preach that this world and the 8 billion people on here are going to be killed unless you're a Jehovah's Witness.
Well, that's Ed, who's a former elder with the Jehovah's Witnesses, and I will put up a link to the complete interview with him. It's about half an hour long, as he describes some of the horrendous things, for example, the ejection of gay people from the Jehovah's Witnesses that he had to actually preside over as an elder, which is one of the reasons that he stepped away from the cult and decided to have nothing to do with it anymore. But Martin, this is interesting, isn't it? In a way, what the Jehovah's are doing here is they're constantly saying, oh, the world, end of the world is about to happen. And then, of course, it doesn't arrive, it doesn't arrive, it doesn't arrive. But so the story changes. It's a little bit like 1984.
Well, it's not just the Jehovah's Witnesses who believe things like that. I mean, Mike Pence, the vice president that's been at the center of events this week in the US, is a fundamentalist Christian who believes in that the Jews are going to be converted to Christianity, and then the Antichrist is going to come, and there's going to be a world war, and only the Christians are going to survive.
Well, it could be the other way around. It could be, maybe it will happen the other way around. Yeah, I find a lot of this stuff very interesting, and obviously there are things that the Bible does say about this, but the idea that they're saying it's about to happen and it doesn't, and then they have to change the date and keep changing the date, I think are rather farcical. But it's not farcical, because when people get involved in a cult, they don't necessarily realize that they're getting involved in a cult to begin with. They then find it very, very difficult to leave, because they find all their friends and associates, particularly with the Jehovah's Witnesses, have to be Jehovah's Witnesses. Otherwise, they get into trouble for having associations with people who don't believe what they believe. So this, the final clip, and as I say, this will be available on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk, the full interview with Ed. He talks about his experience of leaving the Jehovah's Witnesses.
If you've made up your mind to leave, is to start to reach out to others and form other networks of friends. Because if you stop and you just leave it, you know, like a hard leave, you lose everybody, especially if you're disfellowshipped, because they're not allowed to talk to you anyway. But you have to then start to reach out to others and try and get some kind of social network going, so as you've got friends, because we all need friends. I mean, that's why a lot of people join the Jehovah's Witness religion, is because they might be on their own. They might be like a, I suppose you could say, a vulnerable person. I mean, not all Jehovah's Witnesses who join were vulnerable. But if you're lonely and then you're sort of grabbed by all these witnesses who come to the Kingdom Hall, and they sort of what call love bomb you, and they all become your friends, but then you realise, well, maybe it's not what you thought it was. You lose your whole social network. So therefore, you need, if you're going to leave, to start making other friends.
Yeah, so that's Ed, who's an elder, was an elder in the Jehovah's Witnesses, and I'll put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, these sorts of organisations are a bit like the Masons. If you're either forced out or you decide to leave, you can find yourself completely isolated.
Well, I mean, it's one of the ways in which human societies organise, isn't it? You've got the Masons, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Chinese Communist Party, if you like, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, the Carbonari, who were the secret society for the unification of Italy.
The Mafia.
The Mafia, the 'Ndrangheta. the auto unidas defensas de Colombia. This is one of the ways in which human societies operate. Exclusive groups in groups and out groups and all the rest of it.
Would you include the occult and witchcraft, that sort of thing, with all this?
Well, it can do. I mean, and often that will be an individual, Aleister Crowley and his particular acolytes, as opposed to somebody else and their acolytes. I mean, human nature doesn't change that much in the short run, and these kinds of things there's lots of trees in the forest and predators in the jungle, isn't there?
Yeah, there certainly are. I just thought it'd be useful to briefly look at what's been going on in Hong Kong, because we've had the arrest of, I mean, the Chinese government, of course, are perfectly entitled to do this. They do control Hong Kong now, but they seem to have used this opportunity this week, Martin, to arrest 50 or so, something like three quarters of the legislators in Hong Kong this week.
Yeah, I noticed that, yeah. And they've released them all now, apart from a couple.
Well, they're all out on bail. They've had their passports taken. So the idea is really putting the frighteners on these elected people. So it's just going to be China's Communist Party rule from there on now. Now, speaking to some people in Hong Kong, they are, seriously thinking about coming to the UK. It's almost like this is a way of encouraging people to leave if they feel that the freedom of speech is about to go in Hong Kong.
Well, I mean, we've discussed this many weeks running. Because of what's happened and all the protests in Hong Kong, the government in China, they think they're about to go to war with the United States. I mean, Xi Jinping has said to the military, get ready to fight because we think we're going to have to fight them. And in those circumstances, they're not going to be very tolerant to people they regard as basically troublemakers in Hong Kong. There's only 7 million people in Hong Kong. There's nearly a billion, people in the whole of China.
Yeah, and they're not going to allow the Hong Kong to mess. But they're representing quite legitimate interests of ordinary people who live there, aren't they?
Well, that may be so. But of course, the Chinese government was willing to tolerate a degree of criticism in Hong Kong, provided it stayed within certain bounds. And of course, what's happened is the militants, if you like, that pushed for independence of Hong Kong and waved British and American flags and so on. It was like a red rag to a bull to the Chinese Communist Party. And I think what they've concluded is there's not much point talking to these people because there's no dialogue to be had with them. We've just got to put the frighteners on them, as you said.
OK, well, we'll wind up this week with a couple more clips from an interview from, 6 weeks ago or so now, with Tim Cohen. He's the author of The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, a Messianic Jew in the United States. Because I had a listen in the car to the full interview over Christmas, and he was bringing out, I thought, some fascinating things, particularly to do with the role of Prince Charles, who's one of those key people, along with Klaus Schwab, in Europe. I'm not quite sure who the main people are in the United States. Of course, Klaus Schwab is German. Prince Charles is British German too, and see what he has to say about Prince Charles's role in the world. So let's have a listen now to the idea of the Middle East peace and how involved Prince Charles has been. Obviously, he's going to be taking a big role this year as part of the Great Reset with the Middle East peace and the climate change.
So I documented in the first edition of the Antichrist and Cup of Tea that all of these peace process efforts around Israel actually trace directly to Prince Charles. Most people don't realize this. So in the first edition of the book published in 1998, up to that point in history, I documented that what had been heard of to that point, which was the Oslo peace process, which was set up as Oslo 1, 2, and 3, and then the peace agreement with Jordan, which sat between Oslo 1 and 2, traced back to the Madrid Peace Conference and Madrid Peace Talks in Spain shortly before that. So that's where the Oslo process came from. It derived from what was happening in Madrid, Spain prior to that. And the Madrid Peace Talks themselves traced back to Israel's Shimon Peres, who is now deceased, and Jordan's King Hussein, at meetings that they had in London in 1987 under the auspices of a Lord Victor Mishkan, who was a lawyer doing work for the British monarchy, among others, including for Prince Charles. So at Prince Charles' behest, Lord Victor Mishkan arranged the meetings between Jordan's King Hussein, who's now deceased, his son is now King of Jordan. But Jordan's King Hussein and then Israel's Shimon Peres. Now, Shimon Peres at the time was the second, if you will, under Yitzhak Shamir, who was the premier in Israel. Shamir was not too happy about the whole thing and shelved it. Subsequently, after the Madrid peace talks, you know, which this London Agreement of 1987, and that's what it's actually called, the London Agreement of 1987, and Shimon Peres talked about that in his book called The New Middle East. That's the title of Peres's book. But anyway, after the Madrid peace talks, when Yitzhak Rabin became prime minister of Israel, and he was assassinated, you'll recall, in the mid-1990s, but Rabin allowed Peres to revive the London Agreement of 1987, and that in turn directly led to the Oslo peace talks. Now, those led to Oslo 1, 2, and 3 was supposed to happen, but never did. So Oslo 1 and 2 and 3 were divided into three agreements, two phases, if you will. Those phases were, first of all, to be security talks, and secondly, peace talks. Now, Oslo 1, and you recall there was this big signing deal on the White House lawn with Bill Clinton and, at that time, Peres and Rabin and Arafat. Oslo 1 was a declaration of principles that everybody signed and was actually an agreement on principles to negotiate a treaty. It was not itself a treaty. Oslo 2, on the other hand, was an actual treaty. And between Oslo 1 and 2, the peace treaty with Jordan occurred. Oslo 3 was supposed to be the peace treaty, which never happened. Rabin was assassinated. And in lieu of Oslo 3, something called the Quartet and the Roadmap stepped into the picture, if you will. Now, up to that point, everything was directly traceable to Prince Charles. The Quartet was structured as the United States, the European Union, Russia, and then the United Nations, the UN, as the fourth member. And because the UN was in there, it was basically all the nations of the world. The Quartet was headed for a long time by Tony Blair. And you're probably familiar with that.
Well, yeah, he was a Middle East peace envoy. I think many people in Britain raised their eyebrows when that, especially after he'd started an illegal war there.
Yes. Well, Tony Blair still reported to Prince Charles, you know, as his you know, prince in waiting, if you will, you know, under the sovereign. He still reported to Prince Charles all that time. And now it's another British citizen who's taken over the Quartet for Tony Blair. But again, under Prince Charles. So behind the scenes, this whole effort that the whole world talks about, you know, where they get all up in arms over so-called settlements and Israel wanting to construct this or that, you know, in Eastern Jerusalem or wanting to have sovereignty over Eastern Jerusalem. And of course, you know, Israel annexed the old city of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, historically after the 1967 Six-Day War. But all that is to say, the whole thing has sat under Prince Charles all this time. And up until this year, Prince Charles and other members, until 2018, in this case, other members of the royal household of the UK, which, of course, you know, is the royal household over the nation that produced the Balfour Declaration and so forth, right? And had a big hand in dividing up the territory there in the Middle East after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, etc., to produce all those nations over there in the Middle East now, including Israel. So the British monarchy refused to officially have any member of the monarchy visit Israel, you know, after its founding in 1948. It was only William, I think it was in 2018 he made the first official visit. And then after that, Prince Charles earlier this year. And what Prince Charles did earlier this year was a very big deal. So he's Prince Charles had been there a couple of times previously, a few times actually, in an unofficial capacity, primarily to visit, for example, his grandmother's grave on the Mount of Olives, because she's been honored in Israel. And then William went in an official capacity in 2018, Prince Charles' son. And then this year, Prince Charles himself went for the first time. And what he did is he went for the World Holocaust Forum event as a speaker. So they, Israel arranged to have the Allies and the Axis powers, you know, the successors of those, speak at the WHF event this year. And so you had Germany's president speak. You had France's president speak. You had Vice President Pence for the United States speak. You had Israel's president and Prime Minister Netanyahu and Rivlin both speak. You had Russia's president Putin speak. And then instead of having the Prime Minister of the UK speak, you had Prince Charles speak. He was the other one. Of all of the speakers at the event, the two best speeches by far, and I listened to them all in full, were given by Russia's Putin, curiously enough, and Prince Charles. Prince Charles gave a stunning speech. It was fantastic. And it endeared him, big time, if you will, to Israel's populace. I mean, it was a superb speech. But curiously, very curiously, Prince Charles skipped the group photos of the other world leaders. There was a photo before the speeches were given and another group photo after the speeches were given. Prince Charles was the only speaker to skip the photos in both cases. And immediately following his speech, he went to meet with Orthodox Christians, Muslims at, in this case, an Orthodox church and then a Muslim synagogue, and then also with Abbas for the Palestinians, specifically to push, in this case with Abbas, the division of Jerusalem and to encourage them in their effort to pursue East Jerusalem as their capital, basically stabbing Israel in the back. And contravening, if you will, even what the Trump administration has been trying to do with their peace process initiative under Jared Kushner, who, by the way, and you might know this also, has a property. People have brought this up under the topic of the Antichrist, a property at an address that is 666, which is just funny in a sense. But Kushner has been the primary protagonist, along with other direct people in the Trump administration, for the I'll call it the fake or the false peace process with Israel. At any rate, Prince Charles is not in complete agreement, if you will, with what the Trump administration has pursued. He wants to see the land divided. He wants to see Jerusalem divided. He wants to see the Palestinians have their own state with half of Jerusalem, you know, as it were, the old city that has the Temple Mount area as their capital. So in a very real sense, he betrayed Israel with that, while at the same time, immediately before that, giving a superb speech against anti-Semitism and against the Holocaust and the events around it, etc. So that happened this year. And to me, that is a big red flag that we're getting close to what Christians call the tribulation period or the tribulation week, the latter half of which, the final 3.5 years of which, is called the Great Tribulation, the period in which the Antichrist has his reign.
Well, that's Tim Cohen there, I suppose, echoing. I don't know if he'd be very popular amongst the Jehovah's Witnesses on what he's saying there. At least he's not naming dates and things like that. But, Martin, the main point I think Tim Cohen is making there is this important role that Prince Charles has been playing in the Middle East peace process. And, of course, that all ground to a halt, the whole Oslo thing with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin in the mid-1990s. What do you think generally are the prospects for any kind of peace there?
Very, very low at the moment. And it sounds to me as if Prince Charles there, he may have his own views, but he's basically pushing the official British line, which is that Jerusalem shouldn't be the capital of Israel. There should be a two-state solution, etc., etc.
This is the UN line. This is the legal line, isn't it? International law line.
Yeah, but I mean, the two-state solution is effectively dead. Hamas, who are the elected leaders of Abbas, basically is a puppet. He lost the last election in Palestine to Hamas, and Hamas, of course, are not represented in any of this. And are still, you know, regarded as people outside the pale, and nobody's allowed to talk to them. So, in many ways, what's happening here is there's an attempt by the mainstream establishment in the West to talk the Israelis into some kind of compromise, which they're not willing to make, frankly. And of course, on the Palestinian side, the whole thing's just regarded as a bust.
OK, well, I think we're just going to hear the final clip with Tim Cohen now. Martin, I think we can say goodbye to you, and we'll say goodbye to the listeners after we've heard our final clip. So thanks very much for joining us, Martin Summers. You can pick up this show at thisweek.org.uk and sometimes on YouTube, if I haven't been banned yet from YouTube for questioning things like masks, which is no longer allowed, it seems, in the world of Google and Eric Schmidt and the rest of these Bilderberg technocrats. So thanks, Martin. And we're going to hear a final clip now from Tim Cohen as he talks about what he believes will be ultimate conversion of Israel to Christianity. Well, whether that happens or not is fascinating. I don't know if there are is any way of assessing whether this is right or not, but this is his prediction, and he tries to pin it to certain biblical references, particularly in Revelation in the New Testament and Daniel in the Old Testament.
Don't the Israeli state have to show a good example of a good moral behavior in order to actually claim that land?
No. What Israel does have to do is turn back to God faithfully. And until Israel does turn back to her God, and by that I mean become Christian, and mass overnight, until that occurs, the nation will continue to be attacked by her surrounding enemies, and it will become so severe. In other words, God will turn Israel over to her enemies, just as he did historically when we had the Assyrian captivity and then the Babylonian captivity and then what Rome did, to the point where half of Jerusalem is taken captive in war. Those who are taken captive are carried away as far as Babylon in Iraq, and, you know, Saddam Hussein had been rebuilding the capital of Babylon in Iraq.
Yeah, but do you see the Israelis doing that? And obviously, you know, if you're going to change over to being a Christian nation, then it's going to also mean a change of heart. It's going to mean a change of morality.
It won't happen until the majority of Israel sees Christ return in person at his second advent. So what will happen is, with this captivity, those who remain in Judea, and God has commanded Christians, believers in other words, specifically, and I'm talking Jew and Gentile alike. So Jew would be somebody like me, you know, a Levite who happens to believe that Yeshua, Jesus, is the Messiah and the God of Israel incarnate, just like every Christian there is. So someone like me, and then Gentiles, non-Israelite Christians. He's commanded those who believe to get out of Judea, which is, by the way, where most of modern Israel's population is. In the modern nation of Israel, the vast majority of the Israelite population from all of the tribes who are there are residing in the territory that historically was called Judea, including Jerusalem. And so Christ has commanded in the Olivet Discourses those who do serve him, who believe in him, to leave Jerusalem, to leave Judea, to flee to the mountains in the wilderness, to get out of Dodge, if you will, when we see A, the abomination that causes desolation erected in this holy place where it's not supposed to be, and B, Jerusalem surrounded by the militaries of the nations. And Christ justified his command to his disciples by saying, for there will be great tribulation upon this people. When he says this people, he's talking about those who are in Judea, geographically speaking. So it's geographically constrained to those who are in the area of Judea, which is where modern Israel is for the most part. So great tribulation is going to come upon them. And according to Ezekiel chapters 5 and 6 and Zechariah chapters 12 through 14, and I address this in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, and also in my upcoming Messiah History and the Tribulation Period multivolume series, according to those prophecies, two-thirds of Israel who remain there in the land in Judea are going to die. So we're talking about, Tony, the equivalent of a new Holocaust, literally, where millions of Israelites are going to die in a short period of time, within a period of under 3.5 years. And that is only years from now that that is going to begin. And it'll be under the period in which the Antichrist has his global rule. Now, out of that period and during that period, you will have a couple of things. One will be two witnesses, two prophets of God, who will prophesy to the nation of Israel and will be in Israel during that time, the two people who are protected supernaturally by God from the plagues that are occurring and the judgments that are occurring. One of them will be the actual Elijah of the Old Testament sent back to earth, in other words, brought from the past to the future by God to testify to Israel, the actual prophet Elijah. So not like John, who was a type of Elijah in the crucifixion week and in Christ's first advent, the actual Elijah of history, in other words. The other prophet, we don't know who that is, if it's going to be somebody who was born in our generation, if it's going to be Moses, or if it's going to be Enoch, a pre-flood prophet, pre-Noah's flood prophet, who, like Elijah, was taken by God directly to heaven, who never died. We don't know who it is. But those two witnesses are going to testify to Israel, and they're simultaneously going to torture the nations of the world that are afflicting Israel during that 3.5 year period in which two-thirds of those who are in Judea die. And then with that, additionally, you'll have at some point, not immediately, but at some point, 144,000 sealed Israelites. The tribe of Dan is completely excluded from among them. So the tribe of Joseph gets 24,000. Of the 144,000, 12,000 from Manasseh, 12,000 from Ephraim, the two half-tribes of Joseph, comprising that 144,000 who will be witnesses to the nation of Israel, unbelieving Israel, during that period, telling Israel that Jesus, Yeshua, really is the Messiah of Israel, really is the God of Israel, and that he's coming back to save the nation as soon as the nation cries out to him and acknowledges him for who he is, the God of Israel incarnate. So at the end of that 3.5 year period, right before the nations gather for the Battle of Armageddon, and as Christ returns looking like a bright burning star toward the earth, the surviving third of Israel up to that point, the remainder of Israel, will en masse recognize that they'll finally recognize that the two witnesses have been telling them the truth. The church all this time has been telling them the truth, and their own rabbis have been lying through their teeth all these centuries. When they say that Jesus, Yeshua, isn't the Messiah or the God of Israel, they've been completely misled by their religious leadership. They will finally realize that Jesus, Yeshua, really is the God and Messiah of Israel. And as soon as that happens, he will begin to defend the nation of Israel. And when the nations gather for the Battle of Armageddon under the Antichrist to try to prevent what then is about to occur, meaning where the God of Israel is going to go forward and annihilate Israel's enemies globally, totally wipe them out, including all their militaries.
Well, interesting prophetic words. So this is Tim Cohen, the author of The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea and various other books, Messianic Jew in the United States, is
interpretation of the Bible, which he's put in his book. And he also links up the Antichrist to Prince Charles specifically, which he says is explained through the biblical references to Prince Charles's coat of arms, a figure which has been made of Prince Charles, savior of the world, over in Brazil with angel's wings, a large one and a small one, as well as his name linking up to the number 666, as well as various other things that he says. For example, him declaring himself to be from the line of David and this kind of thing, which Prince Charles allegedly anyway has done. So, fascinating way to end, I think, in actually linking up biblical prophecy with world events, which I think Tim has done an interesting job on there for anyone to decide whether they think he's right or wrong. But he's done a better job than the Jehovah's Witnesses anyway, because he's not giving a date for all this to happen. He's just saying, look, it looks as if it's all coming to pass. So, thanks very much to Old Labour, Old Labour Oxford economist, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Time to sign off now. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. Thanks also to studio engineer and sound recordist Dave Bazanko, who's done an amazing job in actually getting everything ready this evening, as he's had all sorts of other things to be sorting out today. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page in our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. And as I said earlier, you can email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk with any stories you want covered. And if you tweet at Tony Gosling, it's the Twitter handle, you can tweet as we go and I can read some of your tweets out as the show's going on. Although I've been shadow banned on there, almost every tweet I say it says this is a dangerous tweet. Click if you want to live dangerously, and of course, hopefully some of you do. Anyway, so here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. This show is repeated after this show and again on 11 on Friday and every 11 and 5 a.m. And p.m. all week on the PRSC stream and over Sunday lunch in two places, from noon at richieallen.co.uk and at camberleysradioqk.com. Do please feel free to download and rebroadcast this show anywhere you like, but do credit it to thisweek.org.uk. You can also request this show's reinstatement on FM. Links to email BCFM chiefs are on the contact tab at our show page thisweek.org.uk, and I put in a very formal request to the board of BCFM just before Christmas asking for exactly that, for an explanation as to why we were taken off the air, and also a request that we're reinstated immediately. Do please join us for the politics show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Black coffee, I see double. Ooh, ooh, ooh. How am I gonna get home? Black coffee, I'm so dizzy. Black coffee, please get busy. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Help me so I can get home. Had a little too much hoopy soup. All I meant to take was one. Now my head is going loopy loop. Some stuffy kid, what fun, oh. Black coffee, help a fella. Black coffee, what'll I tell her? Ooh, 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 I'm afraid to go home.